All right, good afternoon. House Finance Committee will come to order. Let's see. Representative Seltzer, would you like to make a motion to approve the minutes from yesterday's meeting?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move that yesterday's minutes be approved.
All right. Any comments or questions on the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. The minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Seltzer. All right, per our announcement yesterday, today we will continue with public testimony and comment on the Delete All Amendment. But because of the time to get through, and it is a lengthy bill, we didn't have much time for member questions and clarifications on the proposal. So what I'd like to do is set aside about 15, at the outside, 20 minutes here now at the beginning, for questions, and then we'll move to public testimony. We do have a few testifiers that cannot come back this evening, and then we will come back to member questions later. So we will get back to questions if we don't get them all covered. I'm trying to accommodate both members getting their questions answered, as well as public testifiers who cannot come back this evening. So we'll find our way through this. So with that, let's see, Representative Slocum, I think we had finished your questions yesterday, right? Largely? Okay.
You did.
Okay, yeah. So, and did I have a list? I don't know that I had a list. So so we'll open it up. All right, so Representative Mariani, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we have a lot of people who want to speak, so I'm going to try to move very quickly. So in Article 2, Section 59 on page 75, we have a redesign of the Achievement and Integration for Minnesota program. And of course, I had authored that bill, redesigning that a couple years ago. And this was a pretty dramatic departure from what we did. I guess I just have a couple of quick questions. One is, quite frankly, where did this come from? I don't remember seeing a bill introduced on this topic. I serve in a policy committee. We haven't had that conversation in policy, and so I'm just curious without any hearing or discussion on a major redesign here, what's the purpose and intent and origin of this proposal?
Well, Representative Mariani, I think, this is really coming from myself, from the chair, and through some of our hearings on the achievement gap and strategies for trying to close and eliminate the achievement gap, and trying to provide not only some other uses for this money with regards to diversification of teaching staff and administrators and that within our schools, but also focusing, and I appreciate very much the hard work that you put into it and the thoughtful approach in terms of integrating work on academic achievement as well as integration in the program. And we've tried not to sacrifice that, but just putting more emphasis, if you would, on the academic achievement portion with the aid portion of the program. As you know, it's a 70-30 aid levy program. And so with the aid portion, making it clear that academic achievement is the primary purpose of that, but allowing great flexibility with the levy portion on the integration efforts. And so if you have additional questions, but I just wanted to provide you that preface.
Well, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the answer, although I have to say, it seems to me this is poor practice for us to do major redesign of a reform effort, or frankly of any effort, without having public testimony on this. You know, the department is in the middle of rulemaking work related to this whole area of work. This puts all that investment and effort, potentially at a loss and a waste of time. In addition to that, the Achievement and Integration Minnesota program, which is a pretty strong accountability program relative to academic outcomes, required school districts all across the state who participated in them to submit pretty strong prescribed self-empowering plans, and it seems to me that if we were to move forward with this language here, we're basically sending a message back to school districts that all that work that they've done over the last year or 2 years, we didn't really mean it for them to do that. We just made busy work for them. And so what we have is school districts across the state who have participated in this program who have bought into this reform effort, been very excited about embracing it, understanding the connection between racial integration and academic outcomes, understanding that you can't separate those two out, and have been implementing practices across the state to be able to have one of those outcomes leverage the other outcome and vice versa. And, you know, and Madam Chair, I appreciate your acknowledgement of my work, but quite frankly, I was more a carrier and a messenger of a whole community's work. It was your caucus that 4 years ago made a real concerted effort just to totally get rid of this program. Even at one point proposing the strike from state statute or state rules, our commitment as a state to racial integration in schools. And thankfully, in the end, we didn't do that. What your caucus then did 4 years ago was put together a task force of evenly divided, six Democrats, six Republicans, to come back with a recommendation on what to do with this program. And if they didn't come back with a recommendation, the program would go away. And members, quite frankly, you know, 4 years ago, that was probably one of the very few bright spots of bipartisan agreement that happened in our state, where those 12 individuals who were evenly split between Democrats and Republicans came back on a 10 to 1 to 1 set of recommendations that said keep this program, but keep this program and redesign it so that we're marrying our goals of making sure that schools are not racially segregated in the state of Minnesota. Do that in a way where we're advancing academic outcomes for students. And so the language that's currently in statute isn't Representative Mondiani's language. It's the work of a bipartisan group of people. And for us, without a hearing, without discussions, without any kind of deliberation, to simply walk away from a strong year-long bipartisan effort to do true redesign and reform, and to do it by adding a strong accountability measure and a strong accountability culture, which then walked over into the world's best workforce, because that accountability measure then borrowed from this one. You know, I think it's at best short-sighted, Madam Chair, and I think I understand what you're trying to do, but I think this is the wrong way to do it. I think we're going to send the wrong message to school districts about this legislature's seriousness about sticking with long-term public policy, as opposed to just constantly jerking the chains of our school districts, and then 2 years from now we're going to tell them to do something totally different. So I'm not even speaking to the finance part of that. I'm just talking about the policy components here. This is incredibly disappointing, and not only incredibly disappointing, but incredibly unnecessary. And I think really would set our state backwards from a very strong message of our seriousness as adult legislators that we care about racial integration and we care about academic achievement. And I think this greatly compromises that work that we set. So Madam Chair, we'll talk more about this. I suspect I'll be offering an amendment. We'll get a chance to vote on it, and we'll no doubt perhaps have a conversation on the floor of the House and into the future. But at this point, I object both to the language, but also to the lack of a process for us to have made this kind of to be making this kind of important decision relative to this important policy provision in state statute.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. And you know what I will say to you is, as I've said to other members, I will happily and thoughtfully consider your amendment. So if you want to talk with me after committee. We could talk offline about your thoughts. And, you know, just to be clear, you know, we have had a lot of committee testimony on closing the achievement gap, strategies that work, and certainly, you know, integration is an important goal and purpose of this program and an important measure for achieving equality and academic achievement for all of our students. But I think it's important for me to state also in putting forward this bill, what I've tried to do is look at how we close those achievement academic achievement disparities, which I think certainly is a huge contributing factor to whether or not our children of color are integrated and successful in our schools and in our communities and their families are. If they are not achieving an education that allows them to pursue their post-secondary plans and being successful in that education, that's a huge part of perhaps why they are not fully integrated into our society. So I don't necessarily see these things as working as cross-purposes, but I very much respect the points that you've raised, and I hope that we can talk afterwards about your amendment. Other questions? No? Yes, Representative Mariani.
No one else, and I do have a quick question, and it actually kind of follows a similar parallel understanding. So one of the things that we did that's being proposed in this bill is to dramatically cut the increase for that automatic increase that's built into the ABE program. I have to say, in all the years that I've been here, I've never seen anything that this big relative to that program. When we were in deficit, we did a similar scaling back, you know, of that indexing for this program, but nothing like this. And it seems to me almost inconceivable that in the midst of a huge surplus and a healthy, strong state that's producing good wealth for Minnesotans and good wealth for our state, that we would go out of our way to cut this small little program that has this huge impact in a positive way on our workforce, you know, realities in our state, particularly in greater Minnesota, where you have more and more numbers of immigrant communities settling in and looking to be a part of those communities, and where employers are frantically looking for younger, skilled workers, and they're finding them with these immigrant communities, but they can't quite access them because they don't have some of the, particularly some of the English speaking skills that are made possible through these ABE programs. And so, Madam Chair, as we move forward, I hope that we reconsider a number of things, but I hope we do reconsider this particular piece here. I think it's a foolish cut that really could hurt local economies. And again, Madam Chair, the parallel argument is I don't recall us having a conversation about this, not in this committee or in policy committee. We've always had those conversations relative to this this program, but also relative to things that we eventually wind up making big finance, especially negative decisions about. So I hope that we would seriously reconsider. This is not a big ticket item, quite frankly, but it's one that has a huge impact in a positive way for the state of Minnesota. And I, you know, it's just unprecedented what's being proposed here relative to these programs in terms of cutting them. And I don't think our current situation really warrants that. And so I look forward to us having that debate around that. But I hope we would seriously reconsider that proposal.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. Representative Dabney, same point?
Yes, okay. Madam Chair, if I may. I mirror everything that my colleague said, but do also want to go to the policy changes on ABE. We've got good providers who are working in the communities, who are coordinating with others, who are working cooperatively, who are successfully taking adult learners, whether someone like me who didn't complete high school or someone who needs to come back and refresh their workforce skills, or an immigrant who, regardless of their achievement in their home country, they don't have the skills that they need for employment here. Those folks are taking these people in. They're working with them. They're turning out graduates. They're getting people employed. They're getting people into the workforce. And they're working with others in the sandbox to make that happen, because it isn't a solo experience. It often takes a number of people and approaches. And then we've got a policy change that we didn't discuss that may be legitimate. I don't know. I'm skeptical, because I prefer to see things like collaboration and efficiency. But we've got a policy change that not only will hurt the folks who are currently being successful, but drive money to other providers, and we didn't have a conversation. It was at least worthy of a conversation. It was at least worthy signaling to the ABE community, come around the table. And there's a number of provisions in omnibus bills across this body right now. This is one example. There's more egregious examples elsewhere where there wasn't a conversation, there wasn't policy work done. Things just show up in whole in the omnibus bill. And, you know, I would join Representative Mariani in saying, you know, this one ain't ready. There may be a legitimate conversation to have. If there is, we should have that full conversation with the stakeholders who have the expertise around the table in a public and transparent way. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And both of you, I appreciate your comments, and I would imagine we're going to hear some public testimony on that. And, you know, with regards to the funding on the ABE programs, Representative Mariani, and I'm very sensitive to this conversation, and just so members understand my thinking on that. You know, we're in a position with the target that we have to work with, and that of doing about 0.5% on the formula for schools. It's about 0.6, so we're able to squeeze another 0.1% on there. And so, honestly, I made the increase in the ABEs in line with what we were able to do on the formula for our schools, and that is as complicated as my rationale was on that. As you know, there's been proposals to have automatic inflators or increases on our school formula, which doesn't exist. There's a couple of programs funded within our bill and area that have increases. One is special ed, which I did not touch or change, and the other is ABE. So all the money that was changed in reducing that increase went onto the formula to try to give the schools the same percentage increase that ABE program would get. So, and I understand there may be people that you know, strongly disagree with that approach, but I just wanted you to understand why I put in the bill what's in there. Other questions? Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I had to be at the Early Learning Council yesterday to get their views on this approach, but so I missed it, but I heard that someplace in here there was the long time language was taken out that required compensatory to go to the school, and now I've heard that it's back to the school board can just move it around wherever. Is that correct?
Representative Mullery, yeah, we had a couple of bills before the committee. We heard one was Representative Hertas and the other was Representative Wills for varying degrees of flexibility in how those compensatory funds are spent. And so what's included in the delete all is Representative Hertas's bill, which is full flexibility for spending of those compensatory funds within the acceptable things that it can be spent on, which is in the statute and described in the bill.
So, Madam Chair, so it's total flexibility then, as long as they say that it's for the things that are in the statute.
Correct.
Well, Madam Chair, I was at both ends of that with my district, and having the schools that were the ones that were not getting and have the highest achievement gap. And when there's talk from about solving the achievement gap, and now it's opened again so that that loophole was closed before, there was a reason for closing it, because the achievement gap, the schools that had the achievement gap the most were the ones that weren't in it ending up getting it. I don't see why in the world we're opening that, and especially an open-ended opening of it, really bothers me, because I know it has always happened in the past, and what's happened in the past over and over is probably going to happen some in the future.
Well, thanks, Representative Mulligan. I appreciate your raising those concerns. I would just say, my recollection, there was also some pretty compelling testimony from a school district that had, a pretty significant number of children bringing in compensatory funds to their district, and that one site that generated more compensatory money, their test scores were actually better than another school site where they had a lot more English language learners, and they wanted the flexibility of using some of those funds to get more of their kids English proficient. So I'm just to refresh you on some of the testimony we had on that topic.
Madam Chair, I completely remember that. It was, I think somebody might have been...
Is it Richfield?
I can't remember where it was, but it was, I remember specifically, and while I immediately said, I'll bet it's, before they said it was the kids with the English learner, because it was a district that I knew had quite a few Latino kids. But if we are going to open it up, we should open up very narrowly, not an open-ended up. And so I hope that someplace along the line that can get narrowed quite a bit.
Thank you, Representative Mallory. All right. I'm not seeing any other hands raised, so I think with that we will go ahead and move to public testimony, because we have a very long list, and I'm hoping we won't have to be here really late this evening, but we're going to have to come back to get through all of these. So, but if members have other questions, I'll maybe try to keep a few minutes here at the end of committee, and then also obviously this evening as well. So thank you. Representative Mariani.
Just a quick question about process. So is it the request of the chair that we just simply hear? I know it's a long list. That we hear the testimony and not have questions of them and reserve that for later?
That would be my preference, Representative Mariani.
Thank you.
All right. So with that, Commissioner? And for all of our public testifiers today, I would just ask if you could be as brief as possible. We don't have a formal timing mechanism here, but again, to be fair to everyone who wants to present their views and to hear from as many people from the public as we can accommodate, if people could be brief. So welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for having me today. I've been before this committee several times this session so far to talk about our number one goal, and I think it's a shared goal that we all have to close achievement gaps in the state of Minnesota, to create better equity among our schools, and to also raise our graduation rates for all kids to 90%, with no group being below 85%. And we've built those into an accountability system called the World's Best Workforce System. I know, Madam Chair, that you have a low target that you had to work with. And quite honestly, when I saw the low target on, obviously as Education Commissioner, I was disappointed. And I would only suspect as an Education Chair that you'd want to also be able to invest in our public schools in a way that was going to help us meet those goals. So I come today extremely disappointed to speak to this bill, because it doesn't appear to be a serious proposal designed to achieve our shared goals that I just spoke about, to help all kids achieve, especially those stuck in the achievement gap because of denied opportunities. This bill disproportionately denies opportunity to minority and poor kids. I'm hoping in the weeks ahead we'll have a serious dialogue about the best ways to serve Minnesota's students, and the real commitment of resources that we're going to need to be able to produce our shared outcomes that we can all talk about and all be proud of. Your E12 target does not come close to meeting the needs of our most vulnerable children, or quite honestly, the needs of 1 million children, which 90% of families choose our public schools. who send their children to our schools. It's almost impossible to comment on the specifics in this bill because I don't know where to start. So let's start with the biggest thing, the formula. A 0.6 increase falls so short of matching the need, it will cause massive cuts to students' programs and will essentially lead to layoff of many teachers across this entire state. When we know we have a teacher supply problem, we are creating a condition where we know we're going to be laying off teachers rather than something like the teachers' workforce proposal, which would grow up to 1,000 teachers over the next 2 years. So I ask you to consider and think about the general ed formula increase. The governor and Senate came in at 1.0, but schools need more. The governor said just yesterday that this was his recommendation was a starting point. And in the absence of realistic targets in both the House and Senate, he said he's going to work toward a 1.5 increase so that local school boards weren't forced to levy their school districts and once again raise property taxes. You know, 4 years we've been able to right the ship. We've been able to pay back our borrowing of $2.8 billion. And create greater equity in our funding disparity. We went from 31% of schools to a 31% disparity to 18% disparity. This is progress. Let's not turn it back now. Just a few weeks ago, Ed Trust, a well-known equity group across the nation, released a national report on funding systems and fairness of funding systems across the nation. Minnesota ranked first for serving kids in concentrated poverty, first in the nation for how they, their fairness of this, of funding schools. I know one of the, Representative Mowry talked about compensatory. This is a major concern to dismantle our compensatory program for poor kids. When we talk about targeted services, and during this session I've heard you talk about targeting to the poorest kids, this takes money away from our poorest kids and allows school districts to distribute it how they want. They already have 10% flexibility in that money at the district level in order to use money for pre-K and 5% flexibility for other purposes. Let's not take and dismantle the structure that's made us first in the nation around compensatory and mess with the compensatory formula. Your proposal to cut alternative facilities and the Achievement Gap Integration Program is a direct cut to the efforts to close our achievement gap. And like Representative Mariani said, we had bipartisan agreement on reforming that program, and it's the only money solely dedicated to closing achievement gaps. Members, do we really want to cut that program? It disproportionately and negatively impacts our cities. When we say we want to help Minneapolis and St. Paul and our poorest communities that have racial segregation and high concentrations of poverty, it essentially will raise their property taxes, eliminate the money to eliminate the money to address the achievement gaps. They already took a cut in the way we reformed our achievement and integration program in Minneapolis and St. Paul so that we could make sure it was a fair way to get the dollars out with that reform in 13. This would be a double whammy and a serious turning back on our Metro kids. We brought to you the state of Indian education in Minnesota, the governor's commitment of $20 million to significantly improve Indian education. We did a lot of work over the past 4 years to rebuild trust with our American Indian community. You know the graduation rates are so low. $1.4 million investment just isn't close enough to give our rural schools the resources they need to change that story for over 19,000 American Indian students in over 138 of our schools, mostly rural schools. Matter of fact, the 20 poorest schools have 41% Indian students in them out in rural Minnesota. I think we need to help our rural schools address the crisis going on in their schools with achievement of American Indian students. The House also does not fund the 867 students at our BIE schools. We may think that this is a federal government, this is for the federal government to handle, but our own Minnesota Constitution compels us to provide a uniform system for all school, all kids. They got half the funding. They get half the funding of any other Minnesota student, and with a $2 billion surplus, we needed to find $5 million for these 1,000 kids, and we haven't been able to find the $5 million out of a $2 billion surplus for these 1,000 kids. Finally, I want to speak to your early learning proposal. The governor is a champion for early learning, as you know, and that's why he took a comprehensive approach. And he first started with targeting our poorest kids, which you said we should do. But instead, you left behind 4,000 of our poorest kids in Head Start. I know Representative Kreisha has said that he believes in Head Start, and I know you've the value in it, but 4,000 poor kids are waiting in Head Start. And we did this in favor of providing scholarships for 500 kids a year at $5,000. But if we raise the cap, that will be even fewer. And even with the new investment in your bill, fewer kids will be served. So it's not an either or, the governor said. It's a both and. All 57,000 students deserve to have universal pre-K and the great start to a excellent education. I know that you put $9.5 million in school readiness, and that might help cover the cost of some of our Pathway 2 scholarships and the policy restructuring that you're doing, but I hope that you will think about the students that are currently in our scholarship program and hold them harmless so that they can continue to have the scholarships, because I'm worried there's not enough funding in the bills that I'm seeing in the Senate and the House to continue the effort we've already put place in the past 4 years. This bill also fails to recognize the overwhelming research that adding high-quality early learning for all four-year-olds is essential to a world-class education, just like fifth grade, 10th grade, or kindergarten. All kids deserve and require a great start to an excellent education. Members, we have an opportunity in front of us we may never have again. All of us have children, grandchildren, or friends, or neighbors who have children in our public schools. I mentioned 90% of parents choose our public schools, and by the way, a Gallup report showed that 90% think they're good or excellent too. So let's not disinvest in our kids and our schools when we can do so much better. The governor and I stand ready to work with you to find common ground that will build on our progress we've already made and close achievement gaps and provide an excellent education for every single child in Minnesota. Thank you.
Commissioner, I'm just going to ask one question, and there was a lot in your testimony, but, you know, obviously our target was lower than the amount that the governor proposed. I think he was at 694 over base from the February forecast. And he proposed 1 and 1 in the formula.
Yes.
Which you've now indicated is inadequate. So what is the governor proposing as money on the formula? Because he didn't include it in his budget.
The governor yesterday said he wanted to work toward a 1.5.
Right.
He also has special ed investments in there as well at $40 million that I didn't mention, that you mentioned also are indexed to inflation, and so that would be about a 0.8 increase in the second year as well.
Okay. Thank you. I just wanted to make sure that was clarified, because I think some of the testifiers coming up will want to echo some of those concerns as well.
So. Of course, Madam Chair, that would mean that we would have to raise our targets.
Yeah. So come back to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you very much for being here. All right. We have a testifier who wants to present some comments with an interpreter. So Melissa Sweetmilk. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Melissa Sweetmilk, and I'm an interim co-director at Metro Deaf School in St. Paul. And we are a charter school, and we serve deaf and hard of hearing children from the Twin Cities metro area, as well as Western Wisconsin. So we have children from pre-K all the way to 12th grade, and I would like to thank Representative Loon and people in the committee for aiding us with Article 4 and fixing that bill. We have parents that came to testify in front of the committee, the Public Policy Committee. And I also wanted to thank the commissioner and her staff for working and collaborating with us to help fix this issue that's before us. As most of you know, language acquisition is critical for children who are under five, especially valued for children who are deaf and hard of hearing. That includes learning American Sign Language. So this bill will allow parents to send children to Metro Deaf School for our pre-K program, regardless of which school district they are living in. And would just especially like to thank you again for your support for this important policy.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Representative Murphy.
May we question?
Sure.
Madam Chair, Ms. Sweet Milk, do you support this bill?
The language with the pre-K policy for charter schools, yes, I do.
All articles?
Specific to the one that is specific to our school, that's Article 4, Sections 1 and 2, in regards to 90% of deaf and hard of hearing or charter schools that serve 90% special education children and have disabilities such as being deaf or hard of hearing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sweetmilk. All right. Charlie Blesner.
Chair Loon, with your permission, I've asked Tom Sistrin-Heisen to come here to participate. We're both testifying on the same issue. I thought it might save the committee some time.
Okay.
And Tom can go first.
All right. Thank you. And please make sure to state your full name for the record.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Tom Sistrin-Heisen. I serve as the legislative chair for Literacy Action Network, which is the statewide adult basic education professional group. I'm here to speak in opposition to two of the proposed measures in the education bill, which would have a negative impact on ABE delivery across the state. Just a very little bit of background to understand the setting for this. We have 44 consortia statewide, which are comprised of school districts and, in some cases, community-based nonprofits, who served just under 70,000 people last year. Our primary audience includes native-born Americans who have dropped out of school and new Americans who have limited English skills. Almost all of them are low-income. We address a wide variety of learner goals. We help learners to attain employment, better their current employment, achieve high school equivalency through a GED or an adult high school diploma, attain skills and certificates necessary to enter post-secondary education and training, exit public welfare, become self-sufficient, learn English, attain citizenship, and master the skills they need to help their own children achieve in school. ABE is a major factor in helping low-skilled Minnesotans prepare for career pathways training, higher ed, and employment. Last year in ABE, over 8,800 GEDs were earned. 14% of all Minnesota diplomas are either GEDs or adult diplomas earned through ABE. Over 15,000 of our students maintained or bettered their employment, and many thousands entered post-secondary. I also want to mention that our programs in Minnesota are recognized nationally for their effectiveness and success. We met our federally established targets more than any other state, and we have received WIA incentive grants every single year, again, more than any other states, and one of only three states to receive these in the last round. I also want to clarify that the average cost per enrollee for ABE is only $763, although we are not funded per pupil, and I'll explain very briefly how we are funded, because that's the next piece of what is very important about this, which is our formula. Funding formula received a major overhaul 15 years ago to ensure statewide access to ABE services. After a great deal of debate, a compromise was reached to make sure that we could address the needs of growing programs and at the same time same time maintain access for learners where the population is very sparse. And at that point, it was interesting that it was actually an urban, rural debate. But as the demographics have changed, we're seeing many of our rural programs growing at a faster rate than the urban areas because of the influx of new Americans that are moving to greater Minnesota for jobs. The major portion of the formula is based on contact hours. Those are hours of direct services to learners, with smaller portions for base population LEP counts and numbers, I should, limited English proficiency counts, and numbers of adults without a secondary credential. The current formula encourages community-wide approaches through the consortia system, in which school districts and community-based organizations work together to meet local needs in the most effective manner. The proposal before you does two things. First, it cuts the annual growth factor from 3% to 0.5%. Please note that we are not funded on a per-pupil basis. If a K-12 school gets more students, they get more learners. We don't. The only way we ever get any additional money is if our actual service delivery increases from one year to the next, and then we can get up to 3%, but we don't automatically get that if our growth does not come to that amount of money. But a funding reduction at a time when ABE is being asked to work ever more closely with higher ed, workforce development, to expand the new Minnesota Adult Standard Diploma, and to serve MFEP and SNAP clients, places that in peril. And second, the bill before you gives additional funding to, I believe, four community-based programs who have, by their own choice, chosen not to affiliate with their local district consortium. These CBOs receive the contact hour revenue that everybody else does, as other CBOs statewide do that are part of district consortiums. This additional funding for them would come at the expense of ABE programs statewide, at the same time that you are also reducing future growth funding. This legislation would also diminish the consortia effectiveness around the state. For instance, I work in St. Paul. We have 9 community-based organizations who work closely with our school district, and through that partnership have been able to build the largest consortia in the state and respond very effectively to our local needs. Under this bill, each of those agencies and every CBO throughout Minnesota could form their own consortia, really diminishing the consortia system and making the delivery of ABE services much more ineffective around the state. In conclusion, I'd just like to add that the number one ABE goal is to serve adult learners. The system was designed to maintain access to services through collaboration and not to benefit individual programs. Most school district programs and community-based organizations could not function without being part of one of these consortia. We're very concerned that the policy change was not heard in committee, nor as part of a bill. There is more need than ever to provide support for low-income, low-skilled Minnesotans to increase their literacy and job skills. ABE programs provide a cost-effective way to address this need. And changing a formula that has worked for 15 years and is supported by ABE programs statewide needs more thoughtful discussion. On behalf of Literacy Action Network, I respectfully ask the committee to reconsider these proposals. Thank you for the opportunity to share our concerns.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Charlie Blesner. I'm the Director of Community Engagement with the Elk River Area Schools, District 728. In that capacity, I am responsible for the community department operations, including adult basic education. I've been in the education career for 39 years. About 20 of those were in an experience delivering and being responsible for administering adult basic education before the current formula was put in place. And at that time, and we're talking about that came into place in 1999 to 2000, as Tom said, 15 years ago. Prior to that time, part of my career was spent in Litchfield, Minnesota, which is about 60 miles west of here, a much smaller district than Elk River, where I am today. And at the time, the challenge with the adult basic education formula and funding was that we really didn't have a formula, and it mattered more significantly where your zip code was as to whether you're going to have any money, and particularly the metro versus outstate kind of situation. So the challenge at that time with creating a formula that was going to really work was that it needed to work in Ballatin and Barnesville and in Burnsville. It needed to work across the state. And after a very long and arduous bunch of work that a number of us were deeply involved in, was the result of the current formula that's been in place for the past 15 years and working, I might say, very, very well. As Tom said, we're seeing growth across the state. Adult basic education and ESL services are being delivered universally across the state. If you're in a school district, they will have that program. And the formula has allowed even the really small district to have a basic amount of revenue in order to provide a good quality program for its residents. Another thing that occurred at that same time was the state as a policy. Again, I want to speak to this in terms of policy and a deviation from the policy, something that I think is not good policy practice. Another thing that the state implicated at that time was you can't keep going it alone. When I was in Litchfield, we were a one-district adult basic education program. The guy down the road in their district in Dassel, Cocado, had their own program. So we were encouraged, incentivized, almost told, you will collaborate. We're not going to deal with a million individual districts. We want you to be in consortia. The Elk River District right now is in a 7 or 8 district consortia called Metro North. The last time I looked, I think we probably are serving about 800,000 residents through 7 districts, Anoka, Hennepin, Elk River, Forest Lake, St. Francis, Fridley, Spring Lake Park, Columbia Heights. So the point at that time was you need to play well in the sandbox, as Representative Dabney mentioned. At that time, community-based organizations, school districts, anyone with an interest in adult basic education were encouraged to be in collaboration and work together to deliver these services in a seamless way. This particular couple of elements in this bill, I think, are going to would lead to doubling up services, something that we sure don't want to be doing with education dollars as limited as they are here in Minnesota. We don't need to have multiple services being multiple agencies trying to serve the same population in the same geographic area, and then having revenues from the state following those citizens and actually being paid twice by the state. So not a good practice. I think the limited state resources we do have shouldn't be spent on encouraging a duplication of services. Finally, the design, I think, is a good delivery system was the original intent of the remaking of the policy back in 2000. I want to speak as well to the 3% growth factor. That might look to some as a nice, easy inflator that's just there. And the reality is that is currently a part of our state policy in terms of budget projections for the future. Foundation aid formula is calculated with growth. There are growth factors included in that. This is the same as that in terms of we are not getting prepaid for what we're going to be doing, but we're provided some dollars based on what we expect to be the number of hours that are going to need to be delivered in the subsequent year. I too wish that these two issues had a hearing so that we could have had an opportunity to speak to them. Appreciate today's opportunity and to just weigh in on behalf of the Minnesota Community Ed Association, the Metro North Community Ed Consortium, and our district, that I don't think that either of these are good practices, and I would encourage you to not include them in the bill.
Thank you. Mr. Aronson, why don't you come on down to the table? And I'm noting, I have notes on here of people who cannot come back this evening. If you are able to come back, I would like to get to the people who cannot first. And also, I have a note that there's a parent who's coming, and I'm not sure if Maureen Ramirez is the parent or there's a parent coming and parent. Okay, so if you would be ready after Mr. Aronson, we'll take your testimony next. Representative Murphy, did you have a question? Okay, thank you. Mr. Aronson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Roger Aronson. I represent the Elementary and Secondary Principals Association, and we want to comment on a few of the provisions that are in the bill here. As you know, yesterday from your review of the bills, there's $3 million in new money in the first year and $6 million in new money in the second year for the College and the Schools program. This is a major initiative that's supported by the secondary principals. We think this is maybe the first major expansion, financial expansion of this program in years. And this is, we're very, very pleased about this, and we really support that provision in here. Also, we note that there's money in the bill for the Principals Academy, which is another program that school principals are very, very interested in as well. And we know that this is a very tight target that you have. It's obviously lower than everyone would like to have, but we want to thank you for including those programs in the context of this very tight target that you have. know that this is the first step in the process, and we want you to know that we hope to see a lot of more things as we go through this. You'll hear a lot of testimony about that today and tonight, I'm sure, but that we want to continue to support this particular provision in the bill as it goes through. So, Madam Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you. And then it was Maureen Ramirez. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Maureen Ramirez. I'm Policy and Research Director at Growth and Justice. I'm here on behalf of the Education Partnerships Coalition, and with me is one of our parents, Robin Black. I'll go first just briefly and then let Robin have a chance. We're the Education Partnerships Coalition. We were able to present to the Policy Committee. Our partners include the Northside Achievement Zone, St. Paul Promise Neighborhood, Every Hand Joined in Red Wing, Northfield Promise, and Partners for Student Success in St. Cloud. As you might be more familiar with, the Promise neighborhoods are showing real results in closing achievement gaps, and our coalition is made up of similar, comprehensive, data-driven local initiatives that are working towards student success and youth and community development across Minnesota. We understand your budgets are tight. We acknowledge the hard work that you have ahead in negotiations, and really are here to ask you to consider a targeted investment in educational partnerships across the state, both in the Twin Cities and in Greater Minnesota. We're asking for support to adapt and to grow these local approaches that are showing results in reducing the achievement gaps. These partnerships are tracking their outcomes. They're showing results. They have support, cross-sector support in their local communities, including business support from local chambers of commerce. I'm here with Robin Black. She's a parent in the St. Paul Promise neighborhood, who's here to share her experiences and talk about St. Paul.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. 2 minutes of your time, please. My name is Robin Black, and it was important for me to be here today. I have five children, and I'm a proud parent of the St. Paul Promise neighborhood. This community has reached out to me and my children when we were invisible before, and now we're not, and I believe that it takes a community to raise a child. So now I reach out to other families and give them the support and resources and the community love that was given to me. My community has helped me obtain stable housing and many trainings that have been useful for me and my families when I didn't have that before, and I got that all right here in my own backyard. I don't want my child or any other child to fall through the cracks of the gap from St. Paul to St. Cloud to Red Wing, anywhere in the states. We need this gap to close to give our kids the opportunity to graduate, go to college, and even have a lifetime career. So we would really be grateful if the educational partnership funding would be a part of the budget, because we won't stop. We won't give up. We want our kids to believe, achieve, and succeed. So thank you so very much for listening.
Thank you. Thank you very much for being here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Let's see. Jennifer Bloom. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Bloom. I am the Executive Director of Learning Law and Democracy Foundation, one of the partners in the Minnesota Civic Education Coalition. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. When America's founders chose to create a self-governing society, they did it with the commitment to prepare citizens, to arm them with the knowledge it takes to run a self-governing society. When we think about committing to making certain that when someone steps to the plate to run this democracy, representative democracy, we need to make certain that they have the skills and the knowledge to do it. The Minnesota Civic Education Coalition is committed to that. More recently, Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said, "Knowledge of our system of governance and our rights and responsibilities as citizens is not passed along through the gene pool. Each generation of Americans must be taught these basics. Any number of surveys that we can recall, including Jay Leno's walk, get what it's called, when he asks people if they know what the three branches of government are, and most of them don't, and some can't even name one. These all are evidence of the challenge in front of us. And you personally have had experiences where someone might have asked you, how's Washington? or they call you to complain about the snowplow. I mean, it's pretty clear that people don't have a very good understanding of what our government does. The Civics Education Coalition has its work cut out for them. We certainly can't take on all of the lesser educated folks, but we do try our best to increase the knowledge and skills among the students who attend our schools. We've been grateful for support from the state for the last 6 years, including 2 years from the E12 committee. And if you look at the handout that's in front of you, you can see a nifty little map, and that shows where we've been able to have an impact. There are 230 communities that are identified there. There are a lot of areas that are clear, that are white, and we'd love to put more blue dots there. We are joined today by Joellen Ambrose, who is a nationally honored civics and government teacher.
Madam Chair and committee members, I am Joellen Ambrose, and I'm here today to address the impact civic education grants have had in the classroom. I'm a 37-year social studies educator, having taught 9th grade civics, 12th grade politics and law, and advanced placement U.S. government and politics at Champlain Park High School in Anoka Hennepin District 11. Recently retired from the classroom, I continue my passion for civic education in what AARP calls an encore career. Civic education grants make a tremendous impact in the classroom, and I briefly will highlight three such impacts: professional development, curriculum and lessons, and preparing students to be participatory citizens. First, impact on professional development. Every August, teachers start to prepare for those fall classes. For the last 28 years, a committed group of 30 to 40 statewide social studies educators attend a three-day professional development institute called UPDATE, sponsored by Learning Law and Democracy Foundation through civic education grants. Teachers are updated on the legislature, Minnesota courts, and U.S. Supreme Court. I will never forget the week following this collapse of the 35W bridge, where teachers at UPDATE were listening to top transportation leaders in a previously scheduled panel on transportation. At UPDATE, teachers experience a Minnesota government field trip and meet Minnesota Supreme Court justices. Teachers are excited to share these experiences with students and colleagues back home. Teachers incorporate their new knowledge into classroom lessons practiced at UPDATE. Thanks to UPDATE, I would begin each new school year better prepared to teach civics and government to the approximately 350 students I would be teaching the following year. Second, the impact of civic education grants help fund teachingcivics.org, a website housing hundreds of lessons on civics and government. The website serves as a valued resource in curriculum development. I have served on numerous curriculum writing committees, often following the adoption of new statewide standards. New standards often challenge teachers to fill in curriculum gaps. Most recently, the 2011 social studies standards added benchmarks on juvenile justice in the 6th grade. Learning Law and Democracy Foundation developed and trained teachers on juvenile justice lessons appropriate for the 6th grade learner. The website and training filled the gap. District budgets are stretched, and writing teams and teachers are sometimes asked to just go out there on the web and find materials. Just finding a topic on the web does not guarantee its accuracy, objectivity, and best practices learning pedagogy. TeachingCivics.org is a conduit for accessing accurate, objective, and best practice lessons. For example, one lesson I used in my 9th grade civics class is a freedom of religion case, Minnesota versus Hirschberger, where students actually role-play lawyers arguing before student justices a Minnesota case where the state law requiring orange signs on buggies violates Minnesota's freedom of religion, or whether it did violate, they would make the argument. The lesson on the Ted Foss move-over law helps seniors understand why the legislature acts in response to a problem, how the law is enforced by police officers in an arrest, how the district court, appellate, and Supreme Court interpret the meaning of the law, and full circle, we come back to the legislature amending the law. Students draw each step on the smart board, picturing the actors, decisions, and knowledge about Minnesota government processes, as well as citizen rights and responsibilities learned in this lesson. And of course, the relevance of this topic opened the door to a very valuable discussion with students on safe driving practices. Finally, do not underestimate the lasting impact civic education grants have on teaching students their future role as participatory citizens. Hundreds of my students who participate in Project Citizen have learned about their own school, district, city, county, and state government by focusing on real community issues. Project Citizen is a practice in the real community. Individual students who have participated in youth and government extend their classroom learning by developing civic knowledge and skills in real government settings. Last year, a favorite ninth grade student, they're all my favorites, but this student named Jack exhibited great enthusiasm about government and participated in the youth and government here at the Capitol. He came back to class totally on fire and taught all of us his bill, lawmaking, and state government. It was amazing to see the impact youth and government had, not only on Jack, but also on the students in his class. This past January, Jack excitedly told me he returned to youth and government, anticipates being a future page, and may very likely, and I believe him, hold public office someday. In conclusion, I learned from a wise law professor, Dr. Isidore Starr, that as educators, we have an awesome task in preparing our students for the highest office in the land, the office of citizen. Our Minnesota students will be acting as future participatory citizens, and they are the reason why I am optimistic about our shared future. Please support civic education grants. Thank you.
We appreciate you taking time today to listen, and we respectfully request continued funding at the level we had last time. I'm also joined by Orville. I don't even want to say who you are.
I'm Orville Lindquist. I'm the executive director of YMCA Youth and Government. Happy to support everything they have said.
Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you. Is there, those are the people I haven't, okay, I was going to say, I'm trying to get to the people who have notified us they cannot come back this evening. So Amanda Reinick, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, I apologize for that, okay. And then if there's anyone else who is not able to return this evening, if you'd kind of move your way a little bit closer. Otherwise, I'm just kind of going in order that people sent us emails, and we tried to just put you in order of communicating to us that you wanted to testify. Welcome.
Yep, thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Amanda Reinick. I'm a preschool teacher for Wayzata Public Schools, the steward for my union, and my children are students in the Buffalo-Hanover-Montrose School District. I'm here representing 8,700 school support staff with SEIU Local 284 to comment on the House Omnibus Bill. Our members include custodians, secretaries and paras, bus drivers, lunchroom workers, before and after school care workers, and early childhood teachers. I'd like to start with a personal note. I grew up in a rural town in northern Wisconsin with a population of 1,200 people. When great things happened in the schools, the town turned out. When tragedy struck the school, the town turned out. The schools are the heart and soul of these communities. You campaign on supporting Greater Minnesota. With a $1.9 billion surplus, we have the ability to make great strides in making funding for outstate Minnesota more equitable. How is a 0.6% increase to per pupil funding, which won't even allow districts to keep up with an inflation for schools, showing support for Greater Minnesota? This will exacerbate the inequities for property poor districts. They will have to go back to the voters to ask them to again raise local property taxes to pay for the lack of funding. You had the opportunity to allow districts outside of the largest 25 districts in the state to fix facilities without having to request more from voters. And instead of doing that and increasing state equalization, this budget takes away $9 million of state aid for the metro districts. This is not the kind of equity we were hoping for, and in my humble opinion, you've gone back on your campaign promises. After a decade of drastic cuts to education funding, our districts are still struggling, and we need to make a real reinvestment like we did 2 years ago. A 0.6% increase on the formula is not enough to simply keep up with inflation, and we'll go back to the pre-2013 dark days, making cuts to curriculum, programs, staff, and even school days. I know what happens as a teacher and as a parent of elementary children when we don't invest in education. Without properly funded school districts, we're gambling our children's education on the hope that voters will pick up the tab for schools. This gamble is something that I find disturbing as both a mother and an educator. Minnesota students and Minnesota communities deserve better. So thank you for your time, and I hope you consider adding more money to the budget. Thank you.
Thank you. Peggy Flanagan, Children's Defense Fund.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Peggy Flanagan. I'm the Executive Director of Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Children's Defense Fund Minnesota aims to ensure that every child has a strong start in life, including our state's most vulnerable children, like one-third of Minnesota children. That's more than 400,000 living in poor or low-income communities. These children face a steeper ladder to the success in the beginning of their lives. That's why we're pleased to see that the houses include investment in the Early Learning Scholarship Program in order to ensure that more children from poor and low-income families access enriching early learning opportunities. It's also why we are disappointed that Representative Moran's bipartisan bill to extend critical early intervention services to young homeless children was not heard before this committee and is not included in the omnibus legislation. On any given night in our state, 840 infants and toddlers are homeless. Homeless infants and toddlers experience developmental delays at more than four times the rate of other children. 54% of homeless infants and toddlers have a developmental delay, and the majority have a delay in more than one domain. Part C early intervention services, which can include physical therapy, speech therapy, occupational therapy for fine and gross motor skills, effectively works to address developmental delay and is currently available to children who have a delay or are at risk of a delay due to a diagnosed physical or mental condition, including children who are born at very low birth weight or experience fetal alcohol syndrome. Extending Part C early intervention services to young homeless children through an at-risk definition of developmental delay due to environmental risk, as a handful of other states do, would help to ensure that these infants and toddlers are on track to meet developmental milestones and could have healthy childhoods and productive adulthoods. One study showed that 33% of children receiving Part C did not need special education by second or third grade. Part C improves child outcomes and prevents the need for costly future remedial services. We believe strongly in this program and believe that it is an effective way to close some of the largest achievement gaps in our state. We want to ensure that our children and families can connect with these critical services, and we look forward to working with you and on this committee to ensure we can move this important issue in the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Are all of you people who cannot come back tonight? Okay. Okay, so.
Miguel Kelly, I'm on the list, and I'm from Duluth, so I'd like to go home.
Go ahead.
Sorry, we would do it up there.
That's a good reason, Miss Kelly. Come on up. Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Gail Kelly. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Head Start Association, and I do live in Duluth. And I represent the 33 Head Start programs across Minnesota. I want to say I've participated in the legislative process for the last 15 years from this gallery. And I've heard the People's House debate the need for high-quality, comprehensive early childhood services for our most at-risk children. And I think I've heard general agreement now that the legislature wants to close the achievement gap for our communities of color, and that they have decided that high-quality early learning is a means to that end. So I'm here to say that the Head Start community is most disheartened that the House chose not to include any new investments for Head Start in its budget. Minnesota Head Start has brought to you real data that shows that with our comprehensive family-centered approach, we are getting the most disadvantaged children ready for kindergarten. And our parents and K-3 teachers will tell you, attest to that fact. The state investments that you make build out real early childhood infrastructure in our community. Licensed early childhood centers with qualified staff and state-of-the-art instruction. And we do that in Minnesota's rural, urban, and tribal communities. From October 1st to March 1st, our waiting lists have grown from 2,400 to 4,000 3- and 4-year-olds waiting for services. Last week, I had the opportunity to be with 120 Head Start parents that were receiving financial and parenting education, and I had lunch with a 22-year-old mother of two. She's a beautician. She's a managing beautician at Regis. Some of you may get your hair cut there. She makes $8 an hour. She attributes her ability to get by two things. Her parents let her live, her family live in their basement, and Head Start. The family approach and the respectfulness she gets as someone who pays $7 for childcare is, she finds Head Start is the only thing that helps her make sure her young children are well cared for. So those are the type of families that seek out and choose Head Start for the whole family and for its cultural responsiveness. And we just hope that the House will respect their choice, listen to the families that you most want to target, and fund Head Start as part of your comprehensive early childhood services. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, and then the next group.
Thank you, Madam Chair Loon and members of the committee. We have four people here from the Stillwater Area School District. Three of us are board members. Mike Patashi has served for 8 years. Paula is in her first year, and I have served for 10. We also have a parent from Marine Elementary under Representative Bob Detmer's area. Thank you for the opportunity for us to share our experiences in Stillwater. And I'm going to start with our parent, Helene Anderson.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, thank you very much. My name is Helene Anderson. I live in Marine on St. Croix. I have two boys, third and fourth grade. The students of Minnesota urgently need your help. Please support a further increase to the basic general education formula to help restore adequate and equitable funding statewide. With the current $1.9 billion surplus, the proposals we have before us come up woefully short with education funding this session. Although this is a district and statewide need, I can tell you only our school situation to illustrate this is a real need. Once again, District 834, like many others, is facing severe operational budget cuts that will negatively impact the quality of education of our students. As you may know, Marine Elementary is a small school in the northern part of the Stillwater School District. Last year, because of operational deficits, our budget was cut by about $72,000 for a very small school. It was a major cut. We lost some essential services like math intervention and instructional coaching, and other services were reduced. Nevertheless, we tried to be the little school that could. We are now ranked number 2 in the state based on test scores, and we are nationally recognized. Unfortunately, this year, a Marine teacher has been cut. The administration has recommended that we go to a multi-grade system, replacing trained teachers with paraprofessionals. With only one teacher per grade and the rigorous state standards, this is devastating to our small school. In the scheme of things, Marine Elementary's problems aren't huge. This story and similar ones are repeating themselves in many communities in our district and across the state. But the cuts are not to fat, but they are to necessities. Even a 1% increase to the general formula doesn't keep up with inflation and will result in further widespread teacher cuts, increased class sizes, less technology for students, larger achievement gaps, and additional operating levy referendums that put more burden on taxpayers. Thank you for your service and your time.
Madam Chair, representatives, thank you for allowing us to speak. Many of you are well acquainted with the old adage, hope for the best, plan for the worst. Unfortunately, I'm going to convey a little bit of our planning for the worst. In preparation for the 2015-16 school year, the Stillwater Area School District
could you introduce yourself? We didn't get your name.
My apologies. Mike Potachik, and I'm a school board member.
Potachik.
Good Irish.
Thank you.
In preparation, again, if I can just restart, in preparation for the upcoming school year, the Stillwater Area School District has reduced our budget by $2.5 million. This includes a reduction in health insurance benefits to maintain the current rate, a reduction in special education positions, a reduction in nursing positions, moving to multi-grade classrooms to save the cost of 6.7 teaching positions, reductions in technology, reduction in technology staffing at the building level, reductions in the services of our alternative learning center, and a major reduction between $400,000 and $500,000 at the district office, which affects two cabinet positions being eliminated, and over a $200,000 reduction on curriculum materials to support the classroom. This is on the top of a reduction, as Helena mentioned, in staffing positions last year that increased class sizes across the district. Lastly, an increase of 0.6% in each year of the formula will not come close to closing the gap on these reductions.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Paula O'Loughlin from Stillwater Area Public Schools, and I, too, very much appreciate the opportunity to speak before you this afternoon. As a school board member, I come to you representing a very large contingent of parents who are quite frankly, disheartened and dismayed and disappointed in the current proposal on the formula. These are parents who believe deeply and support greatly public education, but they are simply seeing that the cuts that they've encountered over the years have a great impact on their students. Most importantly, I'm here representing over our 8,000 students that we have the privilege and honor of serving each and every day. And those students have been asked for too long now to do less with less. We've seen the cuts and the impact of that and how that's cut in truly into the marrow of the programming and the supports and services that we're able to provide to all of our children, and we ask for you to please consider an increase on the formula. Thank you.
And then lastly, my name is Kathy Buchholz. We ask for full funding for QCOM for all school districts that have qualified under the MDE guidelines. And I want to thank Representative Bob Detmer. He co-authored a bill. But I'm hopeful that this was just an oversight. And I'm asking the committee members to go back and reconsider funding the school districts who have qualified, have been approved by MDE. Stillwater is on a waiting list. And we just believe that all qualifying districts should have this access. So we wish you the best in your negotiations to come. We thank you for your service. And we, as you know, we are all in here because we believe in public education. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And just either Mr. Potashnik or one, I just wanted to clarify, because you were talking about cuts and reductions, is that what you're projecting or what has happened currently?
Those kind of both, because some of those actions to meet deadlines in terms of when staff have to be notified, they're taking place right now. In fact, they were probably put in motion a couple weeks ago, and that was on the assumption that we would get a 1%.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Murphy did that because can you stay close? Because I think, did you have a question for them as well, or did my question kind of cover it?
Your question kind of covered it, but the parent that spoke first was talking about cuts that they had taken last year, and I really would like to know why. What existed in your community before that
had you in the year that we got the greatest increase in education funding forever. What happened to Stillwater's school district 834?
Board members, as far as the reason for those cuts, all I know is our small school took us approximately $72,000 cut
in 2014.
Yes,
Mr. Potashnik, did you want to?
Sure, I gladly do. As Helena talked about, Marine is a smaller elementary schools. We do have general guidelines, a range class size that we try to meet. And so at the 11th hour, what was proposed last year was to eliminate one full teacher. And so through great effort by that community, we got it reduced to 72,000, but they did take a reduction in additional services. I think as one of our speakers has talked about, a lot of the reductions that we are experiencing aren't something just last year or proposed this year, but this has been an extended period of time. And so a reduction mode in 834 is not a unique experience. We do thank you for what was done last year, but it couldn't make up for all of our financial shortcomings.
And Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, and Mr. Potashnik.
Mike is good, too.
So you are here today not so much to talk about the bill in its entirety, but just to talk about the QComp and the not being on the waiting list for QComp and for a formula increase.
Correct.
Do you have any projections of what the formula increase as it exists today, proposed formula increase as it exists today in the bill before us, what that will entail for next year?
Yes, and Kathy yes. can jump in as well. But most of those areas that I was talking about, that is on a with an assumption, and it is an assumption of a 1%. What Paula mentioned when she spoke, our best hope is for a 3%. That would help us. The whole thing about QComp took a great balancing act to make the applications, to get our teachers union, our evaluation system done as well as part of a package. So right now we stand on a waiting list. If that was to be funded like a lot of districts are, that would help us a lot. Does that answer your question?
Have you been accepted as a QComp school?
Yes.
Thank you.
We've been accepted with our latest proposal by the MDE, but we have not received QComp dollars in the past.
Correct.
Okay.
And I just wanted to
thank
add
you. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
Thanks. I think we've answered the questions, and we need to move on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Is there anyone else who needs to cannot come back this evening? All right. If you cannot come back this evening, please come to the testifier table. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Pine. I'm the Director of Finance for South Washington County Schools. I'm here representing not only my district, but the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials, MASBO. And looking at the clock as an accountant, I need to tell you that you have less than 10 hours to file your taxes.
On that cheery note, Mr. Pine, anything else you want to share?
I get to go talk to the task committee next too. I'm basically here to talk about, obviously, funding and the basic formula. And it kind of came to mind, and I know you've heard it all, and it's somewhat obvious that it's a very low number. And it came to mind that I have a tree in my yard, and it's actually in the front yard, and it's between the street and the boulevard, a real small space. Unfortunately, it's a beautiful tree. It's grown. Sidewalk is destroyed. It's pushed up. City said I have to fix the sidewalk. I call the cement guy. He says, well, the tree's got to go. But, so why don't we, what if we just cut the roots? Well, it's going to die. Well, maybe I'll move before it dies. Let's just cut the roots, put the cement in. And it comes to my mind that the basic formula, that's the roots of the base for the tree of education. And we just never feed it. It stays the same all the time. It doesn't even mean anything. It doesn't reflect the cost of educating a child in Minnesota. It's a number that never goes up. And the tree keeps growing. And the tree doesn't grow at a fast rate. You know how trees grow, little by little by little, but they get big. And that's what our programs have done. And that's the stuff our kids deserve and our parents deserve. But once we cut those roots and we wreck that base and we put this tree in too small of a space, that tree should have been planted in the backyard where it would never have to be cut down. But it's in too small space, the base is too small, and eventually we're going to have to cut down all those programs and all this education. So the bottom line is that the formula is way too small. In real numbers, unfortunately in our district, we just got done last week, we sent notices to 48 teachers that they no longer had jobs. We had to cut $4.6 million. We were going to cut more, but we thought we'd hold on to see what happened with the formula. Unfortunately, the formula is the projections. The governor's projection now, or his proposal now, would be enough for us not to cut. The proposal in the House would mean we'd have to cut another $1 million or about 20 more teachers. And I just come in here to ask on the behalf of MASBO that you consider somehow, some way to get the target up and to get the formula up to at least 1.5%. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Julie Ritter, and I am the Early Childhood and Family Education Program Manager from Lakeville Area Public Schools. I'm also the School Readiness and Early Childhood Screening Coordinator. But today I am here representing the MNAFI, the Minnesota Association for Family and Early Education. I have been a coordinator of school-based early childhood programs and have taught in school-based programs for the past 26 years. I'm here today to speak specifically to the early learning program's coordination measure, which is found in Article 9. The coordination of early learning programs is a concept of which we are very much in favor. There are many districts across the state of Minnesota who already do this to some degree through program and class coordination, shared staff and spaces, and shared management of programs. Our concern comes with the combining of revenue sources and the result that it might have in funding flexibility, which could, in this case, specifically impact ECFE, especially in light of the pressure on school readiness funding and other early childhood funding streams to meet the preschool needs of 3 to 5-year-olds. We are very, very thankful for the increased funding that you have provided to school readiness. Our concerns, though, is that with flexible funding, ECFE's responsibilities to legislation, which define ECFE's program components and protect ECFE's funding revenues, could be jeopardized. Some of these
Some of these parameters, which are set in statute, include the focus on birth to three education, substantial parent education, structured learning activities between parents and children, and the ability of programs to address the results of their community needs assessments and prioritize programming and services to meet families and parent needs that are identified in the assessment. This measure currently has no parameters for protecting individual funding sources. It is our concern that ECFE must be ensured that it can meet its statutory obligations. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else who needs to leave or cannot come back tonight? All right. If not, we'll go back to what I've got, Mr. Amoroso.
Madam Chair.
Oh. Yes?
Ms. Lee was coming down.
Okay. All right, Ms. Lee, I don't have you on the list as asking to testify, but if you will be very brief, go ahead.
Yes. Madam Chair, I did email that, and I guess there was some confusion as to when I'd be here. I do have these handouts. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, R&R Family Centers, and also for APAC. I want to thank you for this opportunity. I also want to mention that in this capacity, I'm also talking as a former corporate auditor of Fortune 500 companies. We were looking at this from a standpoint of comprehensive solutions and systems and dealing with the issues of world-class education, global workforce, and some of the things you already have in the system where the gaps are and filling the achievement gap. And so we came up with a number of different considerations, and I'm sorry there wasn't time due to some processing issues as far as being able to get a hearing on the bill, but I did want to talk to you about how we can help and further the efforts through the collaborations of those who are receiving the funding too. And that's why I also invite all the schools and districts and so forth to participate in this with us. We had as part of our program the Prince of Morocco, who is now King of Morocco, and also Malawi, who was the Nobel Prize winner. So we know the accomplishments that can be achieved by giving K-12 the right kind of education, and that's what we were promoting. In your bill, you talk about different programs as it relates to world languages, IT certifications, and so forth. And we have things that go beyond that as far as certifying, so that there's our dual certification in both the high school colleges, but we also extend it to professional certification and international certification, which I won't talk about here. But I just want to let you know that on the back of one of the forms are a list of some of our different partners, as far as who all is involved with this, that we are coming up with the world class or the world's best workforce. And we had maps, which is not part of this handout, as far as all the counties that it covers, which is in every one of your counties, as far as how we can make a difference. But I did want to also... This was in another committee, as far as explained, that there are international ramifications of it.
Oh, I'm sorry. Ms. Lee, could you suspend for just a second?
I'm just wondering if maybe I could take the opportunity with her after committee to go over some of this, and then I could bring it back to the committee, or we could have a conversation offline. Maybe it'd be a little bit more helpful.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Representative Krusha. I'm sorry. Ms. Lee, if you could wrap up. Thank you.
Okay, yes. I just wanted to finish with it's also affecting the tourism economy, and they came up with maps and the international impact as far as the collaborations. We have a list of international billion-dollar companies and where all their locations are worldwide as far as participating. And just to let you know, this Sunday, the governor of Japan, who is kind of like the Federal Reserve chair, is coming to Minnesota. This past week on Monday, we had one of the ambassadors, and that's why I urge you to at least consider, you know, as far as incorporating some of these things into the existing program. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Mr. Amoroso.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I will be very brief. I guess the perspective that I'd like to share is more of a global perspective. Mm-hmm. I know that the target that you received, from my perspective in talking to many of you over the course of the last 3+ months, was not a target that you embraced, but it's a target that you were given, and you had to do what you had to do. But what I think that target didn't allow you to do is to truly invest in public education for the next 2 years. And you've heard a lot of specifics about what the concerns are and what the concerns aren't, but I truly believe that all of us need to work the best we can over the course of the next 4 weeks to try and have the target raised, which would truly allow the House to look at how we can better invest in public schools for our children, because I truly believe that's what you all want to do. And the governor has his target out there of almost $700 million, and that's a target that we believe as an association that we minimally need to get to in order to truly have a conversation about investing in public education, looking at all the various facets that go into that education. Our group, our superintendents, our other district officials at the district level, our number one priority, of course, is the formula. You know, you've heard me say before to this committee that the formula truly is the gasoline that drives the engine. We can do a lot of different things through the education bills, but if we don't put fuel into the system, when we walk away in May, when we go through the summer, when our schools reconvene in fall, we will have districts that will have cut programs, we will have cut staff, we will have raised student fees, and those aren't things I believe that any of us want to see. And so our association pledges to you, and we've been doing our campaign of contacting all the members of the House, the governor, contacting the Senate, to try and have that target raised. And I'm hoping that if over the course of the next few weeks that target gets raised, that there can be conversations about how can we truly meet the needs of our students. And I would ask you to respectfully, because I think we're going to get a larger target. I really do think we're going to get a larger target from the House. I'm hoping that when we get to that point, that the formula becomes a significant player in those conversations. With that, I thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you very much. As I indicated yesterday afternoon, I was surprised that on the number of people that asked to speak at that time, and it's since doubled.
Yes.
But, and obviously from what you've said, we're going to meet tonight.
Correct.
And that's fine with me. But I would like to learn more about what people anticipate the bill that's before us will do to their areas, and have more information about what's going to happen in school districts. I really appreciate the civility that and cordiality that people have brought to the podium today, and I know that people want to continue to remind us of what they've asked for in previous hearings, but more than that, I would like to know actual situations. You say someone that walks down here and says we're going to cut, just for example, 48 teachers, and now with the percent that's on our spreadsheet, it's going to be 20 more. Out of how many? And more details on real effects that this bill has, and more details about particular things in each of the articles, I would find beneficial. And then I won't ask so many questions. But if people could update their presentation a little bit as we go tonight.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. And I would echo your comments. I understand, and we've heard a lot of testimony from school districts and others concerned about the target, and I understand, and I fully acknowledge those concerns. But if there's any comments people would like to make about what we put in the bill with the target we had to work with, I think we may find those comments of interest. So
yes.
I would just offer that up to future testifiers, and I think your suggestions are are well-founded, Representative Murphy. We're like 2 minutes from, so I think what we'll do, is there any other member questions at this point? Or anything, a seed you wanted to plant before we come back this evening? Representative Crescia?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Murphy, thank you for that. And I was thinking back to the comments that began us earlier with the open conversation and the transparency in the public, and I just thought it'd be important to recognize this is part of that process. This is part of that public and transparency process. So what you bring up, Representative Murphy, is absolutely right on, that this is part of us getting to whatever that end game will be. So thank you.
Representative Anzels.
I can't resist this, Madam Chair. You know, most of you on this committee have never appeared before the committee or a committee in this legislature. I have. And just so you know, there's always the possibility that if a testifier gets too much into detail and too honest and perhaps a little too critical, their situation could get a little worse.
Good reminder.
Thank you, Representative Anzels. Okay, so members, a couple of things. First is if you'd please put your materials in your folders, and then that'll save a few trees, and we'll make sure you have your information tonight. And then we will be recessing the committee to the call of the chair, but basically about 6 o'clock. I'm planning to come back. And Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, just a quick question. Yesterday when staff was going through the summary, they indicated that there were some corrections that needed to be made to the summary. So I know that there is another summary here, but I just want to make sure that's the corrected one, or is that a duplicate? Or?
Thank you, Representative Mariani. It's my understanding that, yes, it is the corrected version. Yes. Representative Markworth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we come back tonight, is it just to hear testimony?
Yes, we will just be completing public testimony. And again, if there's any other general member questions, we can cover those as well.
Thank you.
And so, members, just for as a reminder, again, 6 o'clock for reconvening. 5 o'clock today is the deadline for filing amendments. And if you have any amendments that you would like to discuss with me, and some of you have, if you haven't already, please, I would really look forward to the opportunity to discuss them with you. And any other questions?
What room?
We will be back here in room 5 at 6 o'clock. All right, other questions? All right, with that, the committee's in recess. Thank you. This committee will reconvene. Thank you, members. Appreciate your patience. Hopefully everybody got a bite, and we'll get back to public testimony. So, and again, to our testifiers, for anybody who was here earlier, and I think you heard Representative Murphy's suggestions, which I would concur. I understand there's a lot of concern and discussion about the target, but if you could kind of talk about, what's in the bill and things that you like or don't like, that would be, I think, helpful and instructive to the committee, and also in trying not to repeat a lot of the things that have been said. So if we could hear any new things. I know that there's a lot of committees meeting right now and a lot of competing demands on members' time, so we'll try to not have this take longer than need to. So with that, let's see. I have next on the list Scott Kroonquist. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. Appreciate the opportunity to just offer a few comments this evening. Start out with a few, as per your wishes, a few specific items in the bill, and a couple that we really support and appreciate in relating to local control. There's some really enhanced local control initiatives. Number one, allowing school boards to implement a flexible learning year. We think that's clearly a local decision, and we appreciate that. Likewise, allowing greater flexibility with the compensatory revenue and fund transfers. Those are issues that our board has long supported, and we appreciate them. You have slight discussion about this, but I think, as you pointed out, Madam Chair, the compensatory revenue would still have to be spent on the stated purposes in statute, and it actually will allow us to better target those resources at the very students that they're meant to help. There's also expanded and allowable uses for basic skills revenue and staff development revenue. Again, we think positive changes. Two areas that are receiving an increase in the bill, school readiness and concurrent enrollment, both outstanding programs that really help close the achievement gap, help kids prepare kids for college and career. So we very much support those increases. And then just a couple areas of concern. This one was also discussed earlier, the integration changes. And quite frankly, Madam Chair members, we are still trying to digest the changes in the bill and getting feedback from some of our members. But as you all know, there were major changes to the integration program just last biennium. And in fact, several of our members were very involved, served on various working groups, task forces, and had a lot of input to that process, and we're really quite happy with the work that was done and how things turned out with that program. I think, as you all know, we are right in the middle of the rule being amended, and so I guess the bottom line is we'd like to see a little stability there before really embarking on significant new changes to that program. And then lastly, I do have to talk about the target, and you know, the bottom line, as others have mentioned, it's not sufficient to adequately address the needs of your school districts. And we just recently completed a survey of our member school districts. We asked them to assume a 1% increase in the formula. Under that assumption, our 39 members are looking at an $86 million shortfall cumulatively, which would result in 475 staff layoffs. So clearly, you know, anything less than a 1% formula increase would have even more negative consequences. So we're hoping that we can instead strive to reach the governor's target. We think his funding level is what we need, quite frankly, if we're going to address not only inflationary cost pressures, but try to move forward with meeting the goals established in the world's best workforce legislation. So I'm going to stop there. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And Mr. Prunkus, just to clarify so I understand, when you talked about the $86 million shortfall, is that 1% each year or per the governor's original proposal?
Correct. It's a 1%, but the survey is only looking at next year. We just asked them to look at the 2015-16 school year, so that shortfall would be for next school year.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kronquist, you said 475. How many school districts?
39 school districts. Yep.
And how many teachers are employed by those 39 school districts?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to get back to
that. The layoffs wasn't just teachers, right?
Correct. Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, the 475, I think that breakdown was pretty close to half and half, half licensed, half non-licensed staff.
And if we could have then the total number of employees currently.
Sure, I can get that. Madam Chair, yes. And Representative Murphy, yes, we can get that for you.
Thank you, Mr. Kronquist.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Could you hold on one second, Representative Crescia?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two quick questions. Of those 39 schools, have all of them exhausted their levy options?
Madam Chair, Representative Crescia, no. There would be some that would still have room to go out. They're still under the cap.
Representative Crescia.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And the second question is, if you could delineate on those, how much of those perceived cuts would come from extracurricular and so forth versus basic educational, that would be helpful. I know we hear a lot about cuts, but sometimes I don't know that is always positioned correctly.
Mr.
Madam Chair and Representative Crescia, we didn't ask for that level of detail, and because quite frankly our school districts wouldn't be ready to give us that level of detail yet. So what we did get was the shortfall amount and then how many staff layoffs that would translate into, but that's as much as we have right now for you.
Mr. Newton, Representative Newton.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I'll just mention District 11 because that's one of your districts. We have roughly 3,000 teachers, and we're looking at laying off 250 teachers. Mm-hmm. However, we also hire about 300 teachers a year. So what it really means is that rather than laying off teachers, we probably won't be hiring teachers, and we'll be increasing class size by about 4 to 5 students per classroom across the district. So that's huge. And for teachers, that's just as important, I think, as not being hired, is to have, you know, extremely large class sizes. And I don't know if that's true for all of the AMSD schools. I'm sure some will actually be laying off people.
Mr. Kernquist.
Madam Chair, and Representative Newton, yes, and it would vary. But, yeah, you're absolutely correct. A result certainly will be higher class sizes, I think, for our member districts.
Great. Thank you very much. All right. So, Education Minnesota, Kathy McLeady and Paul Wickler. Apologize. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, my name is Kathy Micheletti with Education Minnesota, and we have 70,000 member educators across the state. This year, we have consistently focused on 4 main funding priorities: increases to the formula, teacher development and evaluation, access to universal pre-K, and full-service community schools. We do appreciate that this committee heard Representative Murphy's full-service community schools bill, but are disappointed that it did not make it into the final bill. As you may remember from the testimony, the services provided for in this bill would significantly help reduce the achievement gap. Minnesota has made significant investments over the past years to help all students succeed, and now we have an almost $2 billion surplus, which presents a prime opportunity to continue to build on this progress. I'll now turn it over to my colleague for some additional specifics. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, my name is Paul Winkler. I work with Education Minnesota. I'm also a former 9th grade civics teacher. I loved teaching, and when I taught civics, the students and I always talked about how values and choices created the history of our democracy, from the Three-Fifths Compromise to going to war. Our leaders then and now use their values to guide their choices. This education budget, like all budgets, is also about values and choices. We are deeply disheartened about the choices and values that are reflected in this budget. With a $2 billion surplus, you could have made vastly different choices. You could have chosen to put more money in the formula. And the ramifications for our students that you did not are enormous. For instance, students in Detroit Lakes will lose 12 teachers due to layoffs. Students will lose $2 million in Forest Lake. In Onamia, 11 teachers will be laid off. And maybe even worse, according to our members, staff morale has taken, quote, nosedive. Hayfield will lose ag programs. Farmington is raising fees. This is not only bad for students and class size, but bad for communities, our families, and our teachers. Layoff notices are happening all across the state based on the governor's 1% and 1%. But this bill isn't even that. So not only will our districts have to enact these cuts, the true impact may be even worse. Cuts mean fewer electives and larger class sizes. 0.6%, $34. I'd like to remind the committee that this number is a smaller number than when our state had a $5 billion deficit. At a time when Minnesota is so strong, why would you choose to underfund our schools? We all want the highest quality teachers, but why would you choose not to fund teacher development and evaluation, which will help all our teachers get better? We all want to close the achievement gap, but why do you choose to create a budget that will raise class sizes, raise caseloads for our EL and special education programs, limit electives, and doesn't provide for universal pre-K, which has proven to significantly reduce the gap? We all want to create schools with a culture of collaboration for our students, but this bill chooses to create a culture of competition that does not benefit our students. These are your choices. These are your values. And if you choose to support this bill, you do so knowing you are hurting families and communities and schools and teachers, but most importantly, our students. I would like you to do 2 things tonight. Call a teacher or call a principal, a superintendent, or a parent. Explain to them this budget will result in layoffs and larger class sizes and fewer electives like tech ed and art and music. And please also tell them that Minnesota's economy and budget is strong. Explain them these things and ask them what they think. And then after that call, have a conversation with your leadership and with your colleagues and tell them what they said. And I have a hunch Minnesotans will tell you that our Minnesota children deserve more. And they are right. Thank you.
Thank you. We have a representative from Prairie Lutheran Preschool. Not see anybody. Okay. Grace Kelleher? Ms. B.A.? Ms. Dietrich. And Representative Thiessen, if you want to sit with us at the table, you are more than welcome. Okay. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Grace Kelleher is in property taxes, so I am filling in for her.
Thank you.
So, for the record, my name is Denise Dietrich. I'm with the Minnesota School Boards Association. And on behalf of the 2,000 school board members across the over 2,000 school board members across the state that we represent, I want to thank each one of you for the work that you have done this year in committee. We understand that each one of you is very passionate about public education, otherwise you would not do what you do. So MSBA has weighed in on many of the provisions in the bill so far, so I'm not going to go into detail about those. So I will just name a few of them. For example, House File 2, we really appreciate your approach to teacher licensure, and we hope that you are able to get some of those provisions passed in the end. We appreciate your new special revenue fund in regards to teacher licensure. We think that having that fund available for teacher licensure fees to go into that fund and for that to pay for teacher licensure is a good way to go. We appreciate your investment in school readiness, and it probably, as in most things, could probably be even bigger than that. We appreciate your investment in concurrent enrollment, and we really appreciate your flexibility and local control in the compensatory piece. That has seemed to serve the districts that well, and we appreciate you moving forward with that. And we also appreciate your attentiveness to allowing school boards to create their own calendars. And last but not least, extended time. So with that, there is one provision in the bill that we have not had the opportunity to discuss yet, and that is money on the per pupil basic education formula. And it's very unfortunate that we never did have that discussion in this committee so that we could hear from everybody. So I do want to touch on it a little bit. The basic education formula is the number one priority for school board members across the state. And you can, for a good reason. The basic education funding formula is the core business of educating our students. It allows us to execute the mission in every school district across the state. It is the bread and butter that supports every student, every school district. It cannot be ignored, and nor should it be underfunded. At the beginning of session, due to a $1.8 billion surplus, we had very high hopes that we would get an inflationary increase on the formula this year. And in fact, we were even thinking that it might be the year where we could actually make up for some previous years in the previous decade where we did not get an inflationary increase, and we could have made up for some of those years. And so, but we understand that with a target of 157 million and 0.6% on the inflationary, on the per pupil formula, that the landscape has changed dramatically. And this is a disappointment for all of us. But I'm not going to go into any more about the formula, except for I'm going to respond to the request of Representative Murphy before we quit, before we recess. She wanted to know what kind of an impact will this bill have on members. And so when the governor proposed his 1% and 1%, we did survey our members, and we asked them how this would impact their school district. So in our little recess, I ran back and I copied off about 60 of those school district surveys that we got, and only from those that were cutting, though. And I kind of put together some of the information. So it is not scientific, but it is indicative of, I think, the types of cuts that would be made across and the types of decisions that district would be facing across the state. So when we ask them, what would a 1% on the formula do to you in this this next school year, they responded by itemizing their reductions, and we totaled them up from the 60 district surveys, and it was about total reductions of about $48 million. The range is from $56,000 in one school district, a very small school district, to about $20 million in one of our larger school districts that responded. But more important than the number that they need to cut is what do they need to cut. And so I'm going to characterize the cuts into about four different areas, and then I want to just touch on what they really mean in this student's life. So about half those respondents said that they need to delay facility maintenance, things like roofs and windows that are in badly need of repair, and they have been prolonging these repairs for the past 10 years, and they now see that they will be delaying them again. About 17 of them would be cutting teachers, 35 would be increasing class sizes, 30 of them would be delaying technology updates, most of the districts already said we're dealing with computers that are already 5 to 8 years old, and now they need to delay the purchase again. Many of them said that they would be delaying their purchase of going to a one-to-one initiative, and as we have talked about technology in this committee before, I don't think that now is the time to be delaying purchases in technology when the world is our young people are facing a changed world like it is. They need to be graduating from high school with as much technology experience as they possibly can. So, and then over half of those surveyed districts said that they would need to cut or reduce programs. And before I start describing what some of those programs look like, I want to really emphasize that they had already mentioned cuts to programs in the previous 10 years. And so these cuts are on top of already listed cuts. So a lot of them said that they would be, they need to cut support programs to students, like math and reading paras. They need to cut things like electives, like foreign language, gifted and talented, industrial tech, music, phys ed, and valuable STEM classes. They said that they would be cutting co-curriculars or raising their fees. They said they would be cutting transportation, and then last but not least, jobs. And those jobs fell in the categories of clerical, administration, and custodians. But with that, I am not going to end my testimony. I am going to end it with that we have still not lost hope. We will continue to advocate for 3% on the formula each year of the biennium. We will continue to advocate until the last hour of this session is over to maintain these types of opportunities for our students across Minnesota. So with that, Madam Chair, I will conclude my testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Dietrich. So Josh Downham, Minneapolis Public Schools. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members, Josh Downham, Minneapolis Public Schools, and I feel that you have to be a glass half full kind of person to do this job. And so I really want to start with those pieces that we, Minneapolis Schools, finds that we love and support in this bill. And in particular, the increases in school readiness, extended time revenue, and concurrent enrollment. I think we really love those provisions, would love to see them even bulked up further, and hope in the future were additional resources available, we'd love to see those expanded. But with that said, Madam Chair, we do have some real concerns about provisions in this bill. And to Representative Murphy's request, I will try to be as specific as possible. Our main concern, Madam Chair, is the changes to compensatory revenue. The delinking of the formula to the concentration factor will mean actually those schools with the highest concentrations get fewer dollars. So in Minneapolis, we are moving to a student-based allocation model where additional dollars follow students. And we had an opportunity to visit with you, Madam Chair. We really believe that moving additional dollars and autonomy to schools is the right decision. And so there is $330,000 that would not go to those schools were it not for that change based on the formula increase that is in this bill. That's real dollars to the poorest schools in Minneapolis. The other concern we have relates to the property tax increases in this bill. The primary issue is the ALT facilities aid cut, or shift from aid to levy. And I actually happened to be on the tax committee in the mid-90s, at, before the gray hair, and recall this debate. There was a compression of the commercial industrial tax rates in the 90s that would have had significant impacts on four communities around the state. And to equalize that burden of that compression, they put additional resources into ALT facilities, the aid. And so it's been a 20-year standing provision, and I understand it sticks out like a sore thumb. That's just, it's something that's there. It has very few districts that actually get it. But it would mean a $5.1 million property tax increase on Minneapolis taxpayers. The net effect of the bill would be a $5.5 million property tax increase for Minneapolis taxpayers. I think I'll leave it with that, Madam Chair. We do look forward to working with you. We believe that going into conference committee, there can be things that we build on, and those provisions I mentioned earlier, and would like to work with you on those pieces that we have concerns about.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Mr. Downham, you said the $330,000 cut to poor schools. That means the schools with poor children.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, it's the difference between the current law compensatory formula and the one proposed in the bill. So given the 0.6% increase in the formula, that would have generated $330,000 more over the biennium for those poor schools because it's the concentration factor that's being removed. So it, you know, it creates a kind of a two-tier compensatory formula, capping the existing one and then doing a more linear one on top of it. That those new dollars then would not follow those poorest, the kids in the schools with the highest concentrations of poor students.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Elaine Keefe.
Why, that's cool.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, my name is Elaine Keefe, and I'm actually going to be speaking on behalf of two different clients, but I promise to be very brief. First, on behalf of the Minnesota Library Association, we support language that was in the governor's supplemental budget amendment that you heard last week that reforms regional library telecommunications aid to more closely align it with the federal E-rate program. And we've worked with the department on some minor changes to that language, and we're very happy with the result, and we urge you to support that amendment tomorrow. And then secondly, on behalf of the Coalition for Children with Disabilities, I want to thank you for including the funding to reduce the use of seclusion and restraint in the bill. We very much appreciate the inclusion of that funding in the bill. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Brad Lindell. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Brad Lundell with Schools for Equity and Education, and also a couple other clients tonight that I'll talk about. First of all, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify tonight and the opportunity to testify throughout the session. It's been a good committee, and it's been enjoyable to testify for you in front of you. I wanted to start by saying thanks to including the Representative Baker's bill on the non-metro equity that bumps the districts outside the metropolitan area in that portion of the equity formula to kick that up a little bit. That's going to be very, very helpful for districts outside the metropolitan area. Also, I want to thank the committee for putting in Representative Anzelsa's bill on the raising the equalizing factor for the local option revenue on the districts that have high levels of seasonal recreational property. It's very, very difficult in many of those districts to use the, well, number one, to pass levies, but then number two, to employ district-approved levies or board-approved levies, and I think that that's something that would be very, very helpful. From the Minnesota Association for Pupil Transportation's perspective, we want to thank the committee for putting in Representative Purcell's bill, increasing the transportation sparsity for districts throughout. It's not a lot of districts, but some districts that have some very unique needs in outstate Minnesota in dealing with transportation sparsity issues. Also want to thank the committee for putting in Representative Quam's House File 1712. Which will coordinate crisis teams. I work with the school psychologists and school social workers. They're very, very interested in that bill. I think it's something that's, as we see challenges arise in districts throughout the state in terms of student crises or student tragedies, I think it's very, very important that resources be out there, especially for districts that are understaffed in terms of those support personnel, and I think it's a good effort, and we're looking forward to working with that going forward. I think other items that have been mentioned here, the concurrent enrollment, the school readiness, two things that I think from C's perspective that are we're very supportive of and glad to see. And I guess I'm a glass half full person as well. I mean, Representative Murphy, anticipating your question, we testified a week ago on the governor's budget and the 1%. I don't have the at the level of detail that Mr. Kroonquist gave, but I think in some cases we'll be having districts looking for more referenda, going off a referenda. We have some districts that haven't used all their local option revenue. They may be using that. But we also have districts that are going to be making cuts. There's just no question about that. They were making cuts at 1%. I know that some were planning on 2%, and they're making cuts. So it's, again, that all depends a lot of times on where you're at as a school district and where you're at in terms of enrollment, growing, declining, growth slowing down, all those things in place. And I think that I've got folks all over the board in that respect. And so I think that it's really a mixed bag, but at 1%, it's not a very good picture. And so I think that, again, this exacerbates that. But let me just say that looking at the three budgets, the three targets, this committee put a greater percentage of its resources on the basic formula than either of the other two. The problem is, I mean, you put in 62% or thereabouts, the Senate put in about 50%, and the governor put in whatever, divide 700, divide, 157 by 700. So it's not a matter of percentages. I mean, It's misleading at a juncture, but I know that you want to put more money. I think you'd like to put more money on the formula, and certainly as the target moves up, certainly your commitment to putting more money on the formula would be something that would be greatly appreciated from our perspective. So, again, I'll stand for any questions that you might have, but thank you very much for all your efforts this session. We look forward to working with you as we move forward.
Thank you. Eugene Piccolo? You here? Mr. Piccolo? See him. All right. Mary Doherty. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Mary Gilbert Doherty, and I'm thank you for giving me some time to testify tonight. I have to say, I've been awake since 3 o'clock this morning, and I even took an Ambien last night. which didn't work, because I've been having such a hard time struggling about what I would say, you know, to you, because I know that this committee values public education and wants to do the right thing by kids as much as anybody. But we're having a hard time dealing with the we've sent our budget allocations out to the schools, and we, with a 1% increase, which we've allocated already, are looking at $15 million worth of reductions right now. And our biggest cut is special education, ELL. There's curriculum cuts, staff development cuts, custodial cuts, business office cuts. I mean, they're basically across the board. We were trying to keep the cuts as far away from the classroom as possible. And our situation is further compounded because the Title I allocation to Minnesota has been dropped as well, because we haven't poverty in other states is higher than ours, and it's a distribution formula within the same pot of money. And so we've had Title I cuts as well, which go to some of those needy schools. And so it's been a kind of a particularly difficult time at the district. I want to acknowledge, though, to you as the chair, that we do really appreciate that you tried to be fair among districts at taking a look at how you did the distribution given your target. And I know that was hard for you, and I'm sure that you have some caucus members that would have liked, you know, to have you take a little bigger slice out of us, as has been in the past, if history would indicate any of that. I do want you to know that we appreciate that you put in the extended time revenue and the flexibility language that was included in the governor's budget. The concurrent enrollment is going to be a big deal for us as we have ramped those programs up. And for our students, they can't access PSEO as easily as some other students because they just simply don't have the transportation and the wherewithal to get themselves physically to a university site. We do appreciate the increases in learning readiness, and we do support the flexibility provisions that you put in the bill. We have kind of a general policy at the district that we never oppose anything that protects us from ourselves. So as a school board, if you get the option of making a decision, we let the board make that decision, and they're willing to be held accountable. I do want to talk a little bit about the integration, and I've talked to you during the break. I just want to make sure we have over a 30-year history of providing integration, a robust magnet education program in Minnesota that has been expanded based on input of parents in the community, and it's one of the things I think that keeps people in St. Paul. And it has, and it also has been really important for us because as our demographics has changed, our populations aren't always showing up in the attendance boundaries where our, you know, over 100-year-old buildings are. So having our choice program allows us to have some stability with our attendance zones and with our programs, and to offer choices to parents and students so that they can find an educational program that best suits their child. And it also helps a lot with the mobility, because if you are in a magnet program, regardless of where you move around the district, you can remain in the same program. And so we want to make sure that that option remains available. And I think there's a little bit of confusion in the language, but I think, you know, that based on our discussion, I think that can be clarified. As far as the cut to the integration aid, I just want to remind people that we seem to be the gift that just keeps on giving. We did take a $3 million cut in integration when the formula was redone, and now this is a cut to our levy. And while it's not huge, and since Representative Cresha, I almost gave you a promotion to senator, or some people would consider that a demotion. The property tax committee upstairs wasn't as benevolent as you were, as they took a look at how they were dealing with some of the issues. And so St. Paul actually has a $30 million cut to local government aid. And if you add levy increases from this bill to a $30 million local government aid cut, it would make it practically impossible for us to pass a referendum. And in fact, we would be worried that people who had the means to move out of St. Paul might do so. Because of people on fixed income, the property values. You know, if you've been in a house for 30 years, for example, I could never afford to buy the house that I have in Minneapolis right now because the values have changed. So people on fixed incomes, that creates a bit of a problem for them. I know Mr. Downham has already talked about delinking of the compensatory formula, and I think there's some other kind of technical issues that I would be happy some questions about, like the portability with the scholarships. We do have high mobility in our districts. We do immediately fill a slot when somebody leaves with another eligible student. We just don't understand how the mechanics of that would work. And I think those are kind of minor issues that I think we can deal with. And I know the evening is late, and I'll be done. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. We appreciate it. Jim Bartholomew and Amy Walstein. Do you want to go together?
Good evening. I'm Amy Walstein, the Director of Education and Workforce Development for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I just wanted to briefly testify in support of several significant provisions in this bill. We are pleased to see several significant and important reforms included in the omnibus bill. There are strong local control measures in the bill that will enable school districts to make the best decisions for students, teachers, and families. And there are many measures in the bill that will also strengthen teacher quality. First, wanted to just touch on the bill reforms the teacher tenure system that's going to enable school districts to keep best teachers in the classroom regardless of seniority. Second, we support the provisions in the bill that improve the pathway for out-of-state teachers to gain a Minnesota license, as well as the provisions that enable school districts to hire the non-licensed community experts and the exemption for part-time vocational or career and technical teachers. We feel that those are important measures that will strengthen Minnesota's workforce. We also strongly support efforts to streamline testing and identify graduation readiness benchmarks from the MCAs and incorporate those into the World's Best Workforce Accountability System. I also want to mention briefly support for several of the investments that are made in the bill. There's a significant investment made in the Minnesota Reading Corps program, which we think is significant and important. The bill also highlights the importance of early learners. The focus on scholarship funding is the approach that the chamber supports. And then we also support the historic investment in College in the Schools program. There's important work going on in those programs that are really going to make some differences in our workforce. So overall, the chamber is feeling like the bill will improve our K-12 system and help students prepare for college and career and the workforce. So thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to speak on behalf of the bill.
Thank you.
Hello, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. First, we'd like to thank Representative Lewin and each of you for your work all session long in putting together the House Education Finance Bill. Second, we believe that your bill has a number of strong provisions that will strengthen and diversify our teacher and school leader workforce. Second, create more post-secondary options for students. Third, reduce the number of state exams. And finally, expand early education services for families and their children. For teaching and school leadership, your provisions to streamline the licensure process for out-of-state teachers and include teacher performance as a criteria during the unrequested leave of absence process will both help attract and retain effective and diverse teachers to our classrooms. Other provisions which will have a positive impact include the reporting of basic information on teacher and principal preparation programs, funding for the Minnesota Principals Academy, added flexibility for schools to attract teachers to hard-to-fill licensure areas and hard-to-staff schools, and the inclusion of the teacher-empowered school option. For students, the repeal of the Explore, Plan, and Compass exams reduces time spent on testing. In addition, as Ms. Walstein mentioned, having Minsky and the Department of Ed identify levels on the high school MCAs that indicate students are ready for post-secondary education creates vital information for families, students, and educators. This information will help in deciding if a student can more quickly transition to post-secondary work or whether a student may need additional support. The inclusion of Representative Dabney's and Representative Will's proposals for concurrent enrollment, PSEO, and the acceptance of earned post-secondary credits is a wonderful complement that will help students find appropriate options. In the area of early education, your bill strikes an excellent balance. The increased funding for Parent Aware and the related scholarships will help more low-income families choose effective early ed providers for their children. We also think the increased funding for school readiness and the option for districts to create a coordinated early learning program strategy provides flexibility and new options. In summary, we support House File 844 as amended because of its comprehensive approach to helping ensure our students have the best education possible. Thank you, and again, we greatly appreciate your time and commitment to Minnesota students.
Thank you. Cindy Cunningham.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Cindy Cunningham. I'm in 18 years of doing family child care. I'm a parent aware rated provider, and trust me, all my children go to kindergarten ready. My son's in the Marines and infantry. He would say I'm the boots on the grounds. I hear lots of discussion. I hear lots of dollars and cents. I don't know it all. I've had a Jody's been a wonderful about updating us as citizens on the documents that we need. I don't understand it all. What I do understand is young children. I listen to much of what's being said here. I know I've put three children through the St. Paul School District. I think I have an understanding of the benefits and failings in our public school districts and what needs to happen. I don't think that adding our pre-K children to that formula is going to benefit them. We need to shore up the upper grade levels in that. I have been outside playing today, which I'm sorry you weren't, so I have a very chopped up piece here. I will try to speak to the points. I believe that the farther we move away from family, home, and significant relationships with one or two adults, the more we open up for failure and harm to children. Children need play-based and whole enrichment is needed for their development. There was a recent article in from the Washington Post that talks about the short-term gains in academic settings versus the long-term brain development, the neurological development that's been studied and put forth that does not happen as readily within our classrooms. Even in the 2012 report for Head Start, the gains from pre-kindergarten are, I use the terminology, more neutralized by third grade. So we're preparing children to enter kindergarten so that early ed is not as difficult for them or for the instructors. But when you start looking at the achievements and things that happen after second grade, that impact of pre-K is not as significant as what many people discussing pre-K right now would like it to seem. I don't believe the investment in all children in particular is beneficial. I do appreciate that the universal pre-K in the school base is not in this bill and that the lack of use of the surplus. The largest gain is in the lower socioeconomic families and the need of assistance for them. The Parent Aware Program and Early Learner Scholarships has just been spread out throughout the state recently. And I think that needs and has the best benefit available for children and for families. When we look at early childhood family education, for children and for families, when we look at early childhood family education, early intervention, Head Start, and many other programs, including CCAP, which I understand is not a part of this, but the University of Minnesota has had two studies out and says that the biggest impact on our children's success in school is not preschool. It is on the parents' socioeconomic status, on their education, and on their involvement in school. Putting children in a classroom setting addresses virtually none of those needs. And when I listen to some of the previous testifiers about the plight of the school districts and the cuts, I don't want you to have my four-year-olds. I'm sorry, I kind of like them with me. I think we do fine. One of the pieces that's been thrown out is that the savings in child care, and I know that's not a part of an issue in this, but I will just clarify, that's a misnomer. Right now, parents have an extreme difficult time finding care for school-age children. Trying to find care outside of these school settings for these four-year-olds will be extremely impossible. As a provider who makes a good chunk of my income off of these children, I will be forced to figure out how I'm going to recruit my income if those children need. I'm one of the very few providers actually that provides a lot of school-age care. Most family child care and many centers do not. These children get put in the school-based care, and I don't really think that it's very appropriate to start trying to put four-year-olds in with school-based care with sixth graders. The failings of graduation and education should not be put on preschool. The graduation rates are not determined when they are 4 years old. It happens seriously between third grade and 12th grade. That is where the additional income and increases in funding should be. We need to decrease class sizes instead of what I keep hearing is increase class sizes. We need to reinstitute the arts, the music, the phys ed. Special education needs increased to be able to help teachers better deal with the children and their care. And we need to fund methods to engage the families in their education. Increased funding to early learner scholarships, early intervention, ECFE, the parent aware, all of those are areas that directly impact our children without trying to make them mini kindergartners, which they are not. You will never be able to fund a preschool program in a school at the same rate that you do a kindergarten first grade. They are not built the same. They need to be outside planting potatoes with me is what we've been doing and working on our math and our care. So thank you for your time, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Murphy. Ms. Cunningham, do you have a question for?
Yes.
Could you stay for a second? Thank you.
Madam Chair, Ms. Cunningham, when you're speaking about parent aware, is that that STAR program?
Yes, it is.
Ms. Cunningham. So that's what you're talking about is the process of earning those stars.
Ms. Cunningham.
I don't always get the protocol, okay. Madam Chair. Yes, Parent Aware is the star-rated program that was implemented a few years ago that the Early Learner Scholarships is directly related to.
And Madam Chair, you're an advocate of that program and of that type of licensure.
Ms. Cunningham.
Thank you. I believe that the system that we have in place right now is parent aware for the quality rating. I think it is a way to be able to look at family child care and centers and such to be able to figure out what is being provided to ensure that those programs are providing the care. In particular, much of it is to benefit low income. But for all our children, I don't believe there's a really easy way to go. I think it's a good program. I participate in it. And the Early Learner Scholarships about being able to get low-income families into quality care is what is tied to it. So I think it's a package that should be put forth. I did testify last week at the Senate hearing, and part of the discussion at that point between the commissioner and myself was that providers are not participating in parent aware, and there's a low participation at this point for family child care providers, and that's seen as a strong negative for the early learner scholarships. My rebuttal to that is that it has just been spread out throughout the state. Providers have not had an opportunity. We're your business owners. If you can tell me to go out and do everything I'm supposed to do, but if there's not some amount of return on it, it's a pretty hard sell. I think as providers are having more access to early learner scholarships where those children are put into our care and we can't partner with them, there will be more increase in that, and I believe that there currently is. I have a friend, I don't know if I'm answering your question for sure, but I have a friend who's been a 4-star for 3 years at least, and because of the lack of funding for early childhood or early learner scholarships, she's just now getting children into that program.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just one more question. If you're planting potatoes today, when do you plan to harvest them?
Ms. Cunningham.
When they grow out of the ground. when we would be harvesting them? Well, I do this probably within the next 2 months or so. We'll go down and get the early ones.
Representative Murphy.
Now you want to come over and visit?
I hope there's a lot of sunshine.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in southern Iowa, excuse me, but my grandfather was Good Friday, so I wait a couple weeks before we plant them up here. So it works.
Thank you. All right. Did you, Representative Krishna?
Ms. Cunningham, and thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank you and make sure you thank your son for his service. Many of us who have military families, and I too have a son in the military, so thank you for your work. But next time you talk to your son, thank him as well.
I will. I actually have two in the service. So
thank them both.
I will. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Ms. Art Rolnick and Mr. Forsberg, if you want to go along at the same time, that would be fine.
I'm planting tomatoes, not potatoes. But that Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Art Rolnick. I am a senior fellow at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs and former director of research at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. And I'm here today to talk about what I would argue and many others have argued is the number one education problem in the state, and that's the achievement gap. We have the largest or one of the largest achievement gaps in the country. It has profound effects not just on the families and the children, but our economy and our quality of life. And I want to talk about the achievement gap because we have, with a lot of private funding initially and a lot of evidence and a lot of research, we know how to close the achievement gap. In fact, we know how to prevent the achievement gap. So what I want to argue with you is your bill that has early learning scholarships, that's a key. And I want to talk about the research behind the early learning scholarships, why we think that's going to work, and then I'm going to talk about how we actually put that in practice here in Minnesota, what I'm going to call the Minnesota model that is being heralded around the country, in fact, around the world, because of the success we're having. My bottom line of this presentation is it's terrific. You're moving in this direction. Ultimately, you want to provide an early learning scholarship to every child born into poverty in this state. I'm going to argue it's the best economic development investment you can make. It's probably the best moral investment you can make. And I think the research is overwhelming. So let me begin with the research. I started this. I blame former Governor Al Quie and Mayor Don Fraser. They asked me to do an economic analysis of early childhood education. I tried to tell them my expertise is pre-Civil War banking, but that didn't get far with them. They said they didn't care. They wanted the analysis. And we looked at this research, and I was a skeptic. We looked at what is a famous study known as the Perry Preschool Study, but there's at least two others, North Carolina known as the Abecedarian Study, and then Chicago. And these three studies, particularly the Perry Preschool, which Rob Grunewald and I, who's my colleague at the Federal Reserve, we found when we looked at the kids who had the high-quality early education program, these are low-income kids, compared to kids who didn't get the program. It was a randomized control group, so the methodology doesn't get much better. We found an 18% inflation-adjusted return because the kids who were in that program were less likely to be retained in the first grade, were less likely to need special ed, were more likely to be literate by the sixth grade, graduate high school, get a job, pay taxes. The crime rate went down dramatically. That was Perry Preschool. We found double-digit returns in the other longitudinal studies as well. We're not saying that we didn't have some fade-out. We're not saying we had all the problems solved. But we could tell from those studies that the public return is enormous and we're way underfunding early ed. That was our bottom line. But that's the research. And there was a question that came up. How do you take that research and translate it into the real world? Well, fortunately, or I was fortunate, and we are fortunate in this state, that we have some very progressive business leaders. Warren Staley, who was CEO of Cargill at the time, Doug Baker at Ecolab, Ken Powell at General Mills, Brad Anderson at Best Buy. They said, okay, Rolnick, this sounds good in theory. Let's see if it works in practice. And our proposal was a simple one. Let's provide parents with early learning scholarships and require that they use the scholarship, at high-quality, four-star rated programs. Why is that? The research says the following. The research from the longitudinal studies, from neuroscience, from healthcare, says, look, if you're going to be successful, you have to start early. You focus on the most at-risk children. Again, it has to be high quality. And engage and empower those parents. The previous speaker, I thought, made a very compelling case. If you don't have the parents, you're not engaged and empowered, you're not going to get these returns. So that was the program. Why scholarships? Gauge the parents. The parents get to choose where to use those scholarships. Have to be four-star rated programs. We start early. Our scholarships included money for home visiting nurses prenatal. Look at NIH or CDC, and they talk about the importance of starting health early, a huge benefit from that. By the way, that was not part of our double-digit return estimates. So scholarships meet those objectives. And so what this organization that Warren Staley helped correct, and Dwayne Benson was the executive director, called the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, raised $20 million to do two major things. One, to create a rating system known as Parent Aware. That's the four-star rating system. And then a scholarship program. we decided to do our first pilot in St. Paul in Frogtown because the mayor of St. Paul got wind that we were going to do this, and he wanted to be the first city to do it. 650 families got scholarships. We got incredible results. Because of those results, we were awarded a $45 million Race to the Top grant to replicate the scholarship program in what we call our transformation zones, which you may be aware of, again in St. Paul, North Minneapolis, White Earth, and Itasca County. Pretty diverse group of communities, but parents are parents. And we're getting success in every one of these communities. The latest numbers that came out in St. Paul, on average, about 29% of the kids in that community, in this low-income community, start school ready. 29%. That's what we have. I mean, that's abysmal. Our scholarship kids, 74% are starting school ready. James Heckman, Nobel laureate at the University of Chicago, if kids start ready, if they're healthy and they start school ready, the odds of them succeeding in school go up dramatically. If they start behind, they stay behind. So we know we can succeed in closing the achievement gap with early learning scholarships. Let me just conclude saying the goal really should be to fully fund this for every child, as I said earlier. Imagine the message we would send to the business community around the country. You know, this economy in Minnesota is one of the best in the world. We did a study at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis a number of years ago trying to identify why Minnesota became such a strong economy. We weren't one of the best economies in the 50s. But between 1950 and the year 2000, we became one of the top 10 economies in this country, in fact, in the world. And what changed was our investment in human capital and education. Our women became the number one on a bunch of education metrics. We have so many Fortune 500 companies here, not because of the weather guys. It's that quality of the workforce. It's human capital. And if you think it was important before, you can imagine what the next 50 years are going to be for human capital. So the message to the business community is Minnesota is going to invest in our kids, and we're going to have one of the best workforces in the country. Now imagine the message that you're sending to these families. We're going to tell these families that your kids are so important to us that we're going to make sure they succeed in school. We're already seeing amazing transformations going on. In fact, I serve on the Northside Achievement Zone board. Talk to some of those families who got the scholarships and got the mentoring and what a difference it's making in their lives. And these parents are starting to go back to school. You watch out for the Northside. Watch out 10, 15 years from now. That's going to be a different community. That's going to be an education community. That's because you're going to be willing to invest in early learning scholarships for every one of those children. Thank you very much.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ronick, would you like to comment, or can you comment, on what Ms. Cunningham said about four-year-olds and what happens after the third grade?
Well, her point's well taken in the following sense. If you look at universal programs like in Oklahoma, and you slice and dice the data, the kids who really benefit long-term, not just through the third grade, other low-income kids. Middle-income kids, I can tell you where I live in Plymouth, not going to make any difference. You're going to subsidize. They're already getting early childhood, so you're going to subsidize them, and you're not going to find much of a reason. You may find something, but not much. The other point she made, which I think is so important, engage those parents. Get those parents involved. Get mentors with those parents. If we get mentors prenatal, we get more babies full term, full weight. The brain development is so much better. The health care is so much better. There's a huge public saving if we start that early. So, yes, it's not true. While we want all our kids to succeed, and scholarships, by the way, can be made universal. We can means test them and provide them for all children. But clearly, we've got an achievement gap here, as I started out saying. This is their number one problem. I expect Minnesota to be focusing on that problem as an education person. We know how to do it. It's actually not that expensive to do. The savings that we're going to see in special ed and health care will offset it initially most of the cost. This is happening in Salt Lake City, for example. They've got a program like this, and they're getting huge benefit savings from special ed. So this is already being documented in various places around the country. And I can tell you this is very bipartisan. A number of years ago, former Governor Jeb Bush had me speak on this in Florida. He was a strong advocate of early childhood education. Hillary Rodham Clinton has a website, too small to fail. She stole that from us. Too big to fail, too small to fail. It was clever. So we have a mayor of Indianapolis, Republican, who's going full bore on scholarships. But scholarships that are focused on our most at-risk children. We call those our high-return children. How can you not invest in those first? You should fully fund that first. If you can move up the income ladder if you have more income, but clearly you should fully fund those kids and empower those parents and give them the choice of choosing a Montessori, a Joy. I don't know if you've ever been to Joyce Preschool. It's an incredible language immersion program, nationally renowned. There's some great private programs. There's some great public programs. Let these parents decide which work for them. That's the way we're getting these results in every one of these communities. We empower these communities and these parents to develop what works for them. We don't tell them what school they have to go to, and we give them that kind of flexibility. That's the system we need to build. It's working. I mean, why do I have these CEOs listening? And these CEOs, if you look at the names, you'll see they're all over the political map. But they want results, and we're showing results. They want high returns, and we're showing high returns. And they care about this community, not just 4 years from now, but our successful businesses, they look 20, 30 years down the road, and they want quality of life, and they want high-quality workforce. I applaud, all over the country, I've applauded this. In fact, the Harvard Business School wrote the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation up as a business case. It's one of their business cases now. It's very unusual around the country to see that. And it occurred here with some very progressively. Warren Staley won't take credit for it, but he was amazing in putting this together. And the results are incredible.
Representative Murphy, further questions? Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Rolnick, for your presentation. And I just want to say, having watched this ever since I was a parent and then a school board member and now as a state legislator, you're truly amazing. And your passion and the research that you've done and how you finally ignited funding around early childhood education is amazing. To me, it's wonderful that we're sitting around talking about how much should we put in early childhood, how much should we put in school readiness. I just think it's great that we have this emphasis. I do have a question. In some areas, this program is becoming, the four-star rating program is becoming highly developed, but we have a lot of work to go across the state to fully implement it. And with a very difficult budget target, I see that we are investing $3.5 million as a state, according to this budget, over the next 2 years in that effort. I'm wondering if you think that's adequate and if there are other private sources of funding that will be helping along with this, spreading the training and the awareness of the four-star
program. I really
can't
speak on the private funding. I know it was initially, Parent Aware was originally totally privately funded. And I'm pretty sure that if there was a need to get more funding, that we could go back to these businesses and we'd at least get into the door, because they care a lot about this system. We need to take it to scale. As I say, we should do this for every child. We need to provide incentives for these providers to improve their star rating. By the way, when we do that, we benefit all children. As we improve the quality of early ed here, we really do benefit all children, but mostly the at-risk kids. But how much we're going to need, I think that's going to take time. People say, well, you know, you don't have enough star-rated programs. How is this going to work? Well, when we went into St. Paul, and when the providers heard that 650 families were going to have scholarships paying up to $13,000 a year, it didn't take long for expansion to occur. So if you go down Rice Street, just north of the Capitol here, you'll find New Horizon built a brand-new facility in Frogtown. They had never had a high-quality facility before. By the way, that's real economic development. That's the thing that really creates jobs. You don't want to ask me about stadiums, I know.
No, I don't.
not today. And Montessori expanded their program, St. Paul, because you follow the money. These parents were engaged. They have scholarships. That means they can pay. And when you provide those kind of incentives, there's incentives for these programs to get better, because they want our scholarship kids. So economists like incentives. If we made a commitment, if the state made a commitment that we would eventually fund all this, watch how quickly the infrastructure would occur. The CEO of KinderCare has made a commitment to me nationally. Wherever we get a permanent funded scholarship program, they will open up a high-quality early childhood education KinderCare program in the most at-risk areas. and he guarantees me that they will succeed. So we will get commitments from both the private sector and the public sector. That's what we need. We need that infrastructure, but we got to provide the incentives. And the way to get there is to fund. You need a rating system. We have to know how these kids are doing. We learn from that. And so that's very important. But I think the key to make to sustain this success we're having is a permanent commitment by the state that every child born into poverty, every child, every homeless child, every child born of an incarcerated parent, they will all go to high-quality early ed programs of the parent's choice, and we can succeed.
Thank you, Mr. Wolnick, very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think her question was if the money in here for the rating system is enough. And I think all it is just filling the hole that the feds are, maybe one of our staff can. I thought that's the same amount that the feds are not going to pay us. And so if we really wanted to expand so that we can have a lot of rated facilities all over the state, we'd have to have, I would guess, more money. Isn't that correct, since we're just filling the hole?
Representative Mueller, I'm going to have Erica Moss with Parent Aware here, and I think she's got some information on that for us. Ms. Moss, you could introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Erica Moss, Executive Director of Parent Aware for School Readiness. Madam Chair and Representative Mallory and Representative Seltzer, the situation with funding for Parent Aware, as Representative Mallory mentions, we have currently a federal Race to the Top grant. I'm not entirely sure how much the Department of Human Services is spending on and education are spending on Parent Aware this year, but the budgeted amount was about $8.9 million to be spent in 2015 as we ramp up. As that federal Race to the Top grant money goes away, we would anticipate about $2.5 million federal dollars remaining available for use on Parent Aware, so there is a sizable gap there. The $3.5 million put forward by this committee, and I'd like to thank the chair for including that in this budget, is an important base investment. It's the same investment level that's been proposed by the governor. And that investment level provides the base funding needed, kind of the fixed costs for operating Parent Aware, some of the state agency staff, system administration, the capacity to process ratings, some coaching and professional development advising, and some observations for providers. That level of funding is enough to grow the number of Parent Aware rated programs to about 3,000. We're a little over 2,000 now. Our goal by the end of the year is to hit 3,000. We're on pace to get close to that. So the question is, we would propose that the funding level maintain the same level of investment as currently happening in Race to the Top. That would allow the state to continue growing the number of rated programs on the trajectory that we're on now, so a faster pace of growth, and would also provide key supports to continue to be in place for child care providers as they seek their rating, for example, grants to help improve quality, reduce cost professional development opportunities, more specific coaching and training, business development support, some other supports that have been available under the Race to the Top, and we'd like to continue being available. And so that number would be $12.5 million a year, or I'm sorry, $12.5 million for the biennium is what that number would be. And I agree with Art, as the number of scholarships increase, certainly there will be more incentives, and I think Ms. Cunningham alluded to that too. But what we're seeing with the ratings is child care businesses in particular have very, very thin margins, 3% or less, very thin margins, and so they don't have a lot of capital sitting around to invest in their own quality improvement, and that's why a bunch of business leaders, as Art mentioned, initially set up the rating system to have those supports built in. Because they're necessary. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the time.
Thank you. All right, Representative Mallory, any follow-up?
Madam Chair, I just, Ms. Moss, I'd been told kind of secondhand from people that do rating that they think that even with the $6.5 million a year, that would just continue at about the present rate. But they thought that with enough money and to both train and rate, that they could get a lot more providers in much quicker. Is that correct or not?
Ms. Moss.
Madam Chair and Representative Mullery, in areas of the state where there's been additional private investment to, say, provide free training or extra quality improvement support incentives, where things like that are available, also in areas where there are a lot of scholarships available, we do see a higher take-up rate of Parent Aware. We do see providers getting rated more quickly, more eagerly participating. Yes.
Representative Mullery.
And this is especially a concern in my district. I've been told, but you would be probably more directly involved than anybody I was told by, that there's a high percentage in the inner counties of providers of color and staff, that's growing very quickly and has gotten to be a fairly high percentage. Is that correct or not?
Ms. Moss.
Madam Chair and Representative Mullery, that is correct. So, for example, in the 7-county metro, 35% of rated providers are non-white. If you go to Hennepin County, it's 65% of rated providers. These are licensed family child care providers, so individuals for whom we can identify race and ethnicity. So 65%, if you look at Hennepin County, are non-white providers. If you look at the city of Minneapolis, 87% of the rated providers are non-white. And it's a similar trend for providers who speak languages other than English. So, for example, in Minneapolis, 56% of the rated providers are providers for whom English is not their first language.
Thank you. Representative Seltzer, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had one follow-up question. I just want to make sure I understand. You tossed out a variety of numbers.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
So, no, that's okay. So, in your estimation, in order to grow to 3,000 approximately parent-aware rated settings, we should have 12.5 million over the biennium. And we have, and my understanding is we've lost some federal dollars, but we still will have 2.5 million. So that would leave a hole of $10 million that would need to be filled. Is that correct?
Ms. Moss.
Madam Chair and Representative Seltzer, I'm sorry that I wasn't clear. So the hole is 12 and a half. Yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Forsberg.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, good evening and thank you. My name is Frank Forsberg, and I work at Greater Twin Cities United Way and also serve as chair of the Many Minds Coalition. As you know, Many Minds is a statewide coalition that we created 3 years ago to really be champions for early childhood education and, in particular, for scholarships. It has grown now to be more than 100 members across the state, and it's a very enthusiastic and energized coalition as we make progress on early childhood education. I'm here on behalf of that coalition to say thank you to you and to the entire committee here for the work that you have done, for the leadership that you are showing on early childhood education and for advancing scholarships as part of your budget. It's greatly appreciated by all members across the state and highly recognized. I've had a chance to travel the state in the last 3 weeks. I've been visiting with early childhood providers and advocates in St. Cloud and in Grand Rapids, and then earlier this week in Duluth. And in each of those groups of sometimes 30 or 40 people who are great champions for early childhood, they have some consistent themes and messages that I just wanted to share with you. They're very passionate about targeting our resources to make sure the needs of the most vulnerable children are met, and so we really appreciate your focus on that with the scholarships. Parent voice is very consistent across the state as being an important ingredient to success, making sure that parents are able to select the best early childhood environment for their child, and also a situation that meets their needs as parents. Parents often in greater Minnesota are limited in their ability to transport children depending upon where they work and where the care is available. And so just having really significant choice in those options really matter. And finally, flexibility matters. Again, as parents select the best early childhood environment, the flexibility to make that choice really matters. And also the flexibility in greater Minnesota to match scholarships with existing programs and opportunities. So if a child is in a half-day early learning program at their school, using that scholarship to build out the second half of the day while the parents are still at work is a really valuable combination of resources. That kind of flexibility, greater Minnesota leaders are able to knit together in ways maybe that we don't see here in the Twin Cities. And so I just want to really recognize what I've heard, share that with you from these three communities and the very passionate leaders. I'll finish just by recognizing that scholarships, early childhood scholarships, has been a really bipartisan effort in the last 3 years, and I want to thank you for your engagement on this. And finally, when we built the case for Many Minds, it was built on the fact that there were 20,000 low-income children in our state on a waiting list. I want to thank you for the investments that you're proposing to make at this point. And if it's possible to expand that investment, I want you to know there are many young children who are in line waiting for that support. It would be put to great use. Thanks again for your support and your leadership.
Thank you very much. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Mr. Forsberg, is there a connection between Many Minds and United Way?
Mr. Forsberg.
And Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, I work at United Way, and so I always like to be on full disclosure where I work. United Way has really embraced early childhood education as one of its key leadership initiatives, and in particular has authorized me to work as part of the Many Minds Coalition, and in this case this year serve as its chair.
Thank you both very much. I appreciate it. And we didn't do a lot of questions, and I allowed a lot of latitude, but I think you answered a lot of questions and gave us a lot of great background information, so thank you for that. Let's see. Mr. Jason Fountain, parent from Forest Lake, I believe. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jason Fountain, and I am a parent from Forest Lake School District 831. I do not represent them, and I'm not a professional, so I apologize if some of my remarks do cover what you've already spoken about today. But as I said, I am a parent of District 831. I have two children, an 11th grade and a 5th grade. And I very proud of both of them. I'm very proud of our school district. It is a great district. We have a lot of great programs. But I do have concerns for my daughter in fifth grade as we enter into new funding and proposed cuts because of the 1%, as I've been told, just is not going to keep us current. We're going to have to slash and make some serious cuts to a district that is already very lean. We have a lot of great programs that we do fund and offer to the school, but we're already very, very thin. As I said, it's a very lean district. We've not had a levy, a referendum, and I apologize if my terms mixed up here, but we've not had a referendum, I believe, since 1998 when we funded our last junior high, which was Century Junior High, opening in the year 2000. So our operating abilities are just very limited. Compared to the other districts in the area, the dollar amount is dramatically different. We're at something like $750 per student compared to a White Bear school district of roughly a $1,400. So almost a doubling there. And yet we're still competitive. We're still competitive in academics and athletics. As an example, our ski team not only took first in state, the boys alpine downhill ski team took first in state, but they took first in the academic GPA against all the other, when they ranked against all the other competing teams. So we're very proud of the programs that we offer. But I am here to say that we do need the ability to direct funding where we need it. Our district, a lot of great talk that's gone on here, early childhood education. But in our district, we do offer some of that already on a sliding scale. So our needs are great in the operating. So to fund, to increase our programs. And I believe that in talking with a number of parents, that the 3%, 3% over the biennium, coming out to roughly $535 million, would keep Forest Lake and keep a lot of districts at a level current, and prevent some of the cuts that we may incur. And I apologize if I'm running long, but a real impact. So my daughter, currently fifth grade, entering into sixth grade. A proud member of the Booster Club, we know that there's going to be impact to our music program. We know that she'll lose the ability to have one-on-one instructions due to smaller class sizes, due to the larger student population, limited teachers. There's going to be instruction that's lost. And as a parent, I'm very, very engaged, and I want to make sure that we try and prevent that and provide the funding for the basics. Extra programs are great. We love that. In our household, we call it deferred maintenance. We've had lean times over the last couple of years, as have we in our house, and we put off items. But when we have a surplus, we do catch up on the funding, and we catch up on the projects that we need to do, the basic maintenance. So I would ask that you strongly consider putting in the majority of the budget surplus into the basic funding of the funding formula. And thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Fountain. You did a great job, and thanks for coming today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, ma'am.
Sue Averholden? Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Averholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, National Alliance on Mental Illness. We just had one small issue that we were really focusing on this year, and that was the increased funds to continue to help our schools reduce the use of seclusion restraints, and we really thank you for including that money. This is an issue we've been working on since 2009, but I'm really happy to say that schools have actually worked very hard on this issue. They've made great progress, especially in reducing the use of prone restraints. But what we do know is that schools have some very complex children that no one is sure what to do with, and so this money will help them bring in experts to try to work with those children to make sure that we aren't using those types of restraints. And it will also help schools that maybe have a high use of just other types of seclusion restraint reduce it as well. And this is a very great goal for Minnesota, and I think we've done a great job, and this will take us the next step further. So really appreciate that.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony. I think that's everybody I had on my list. If I missed anyone, let me know. And if there's anyone else here in the public who wishes to testify, please come on down. Okay. I think most of the people here have already testified. So with that, any other questions from members?
Madam Chair.
Representative Detmer.
I just want to point out, today I had several parents that came into my office, and we sat and chatted and talked about the budget and so forth, and I asked, is there any parent that would like to come in and speak today, and guess who raised his hand but Mr. Fountain over there, and it was just, you did a great job for coming in to the committee. Thank you.
Yes, I would agree, and it's great. I love it when students and parents come before our committee. Representative Newton.
Madam Chair, thank you. May I ask how many amendments have we received?
I don't have a count, Mr. Withers, and how many amendments have been filed?
About 10.
All right. So with that, the plan, again, is tomorrow when we convene at 12:45, we'll be the opportunity to offer amendments and discussion and that on the bill. And it is my hope that we can get our bill, or the goal to get the bill reported out tomorrow. I understand we may have a lengthy floor session tomorrow, so I think it would be possible to get the bill done by our usual committee time would be optimal. We do have room reserved in the evening whenever floor session would be finished to resume, to finish up. And if that is not possible, I've scheduled a room for Friday at 1 p.m. to finish. But again, I know that if members don't have to be here for other purposes, many of you may maybe like to be doing other things. So I'm just laying out the timelines and what we've prepared for, but it would be certainly my desire that we could finish the bill tomorrow. Any other questions? All right. With that, I thank the committee. Thank you for your time here this evening. Thank you to the testifiers and all of your comments and suggestions. And the committee is adjourned.